Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. I'm going to start off with nothing says freedom like glowing green toxic sludge water. Yeah, freedom water. Nothing says that better than freedom water. Yes, we want toxic sludge in our water. We want uncontrollable vomiting. Yes. This is what you get when you get the marriage between Freedom Industries and American water. We don't need no stinking regulations. Going to talk about how, why, what, all of that. How you get, and how maybe some entrepreneur will figure out how to bottle freedom water so that we can all enjoy uncontrollable vomiting, just like the folks in West Virginia. Going to talk about that. Also, healthcare, Medicaid expansion. Will his scheme be approved by the feds, or are the several hundred thousand citizens here in Pennsylvania going to suffer because we've got an ideologue in the governor's mansion? Also going to follow up with the minimum wage, working America overwhelmingly in support of an increase in the minimum wage. So the question is why are Republican legislators so opposed? Who do they work for? Do they work for you? Do they work for me, our co-workers, our friends and neighbors? Truth of the matter is, no, not at all. They work for Wall Street. They work for the Koch brothers. They work for the billionaire class. They work for our modern-day robber barons. Show them the money, and that's where they'll go. We're also going to take a look at the war on poverty. Because here's the thing. If the war on poverty has been lost, then the people who have been waging the war on poverty, they've won. So break out the sock for the drawers, the mission accomplished banner, all of that. Mission accomplished. We'll talk about that. Also, your thoughts, questions, comments, whatever's on your mind, what you're thinking. We'll talk about that. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Yesterday, while everyone was in a tizzy over Bridgegate and Bridgegazi and the whole Christie thing, the House Ways and Means Committee, their chairman, Republican Dave Camp, along with a couple of the Senate Finance Committee members, Max Backdoris and Orrin Hatch, they dropped the Trade Priorities Act of 2014. You go, Rick, what's that? Does that mean we're going to finally start looking at trade policy and it's going to benefit our country? Is that what we're going to do? Oh, silly, silly, silly. You know better than that. I guess just read Max Backdoris' statement. The Trade Priorities Act legislation we are introducing today will make sure that these trade deals get done and get done right. I would ask for who? He says, this is our opportunity to tell the administration and our trading partners what Congress's negotiating priorities are. They dropped fast-track authority, said we'll give the authority to the president to make the deal on his own. So I got to wonder, what is Congress's negotiating priority? Abdicating their responsibility, saying, here, you do it. We don't want to do it. No, it's not our job. We just want petty partisan bickering. And I've always said, look, the divisive stuff that they bicker on, they put the show on for us, because they've got to make you think that there's some difference. It's just that. It's just over off to the side. The real important stuff, the money stuff, the Wall Street stuff, they seem to be pretty well on the same page. We're going to find out in this battle over Fast Track who's on the side of working people and who's not. We're going to find out who the Wall Streeters are and who's not. It's that simple. And that's why I'm in favor of having these votes. Let's do it out in public. But, you know, the sad thing is this got very little coverage in the mainstream corporate-controlled media, very little. Because, obviously, corporate America wants it, and they want it big. And you go, but, Rick, what's the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement? TPP, toilet paper? No. This is the mother of all trade agreements, is what they're saying. This is NAFTA magnified 100 times. This is NAFTA on steroids. This is NAFTAzilla. This one agreement could cover upwards and in excess of 40% of the global economy. 40% of the global economy in this one trade deal that you and me and our neighbors know nothing about. unless you know one of the 600 quote-unquote trade advisors, which are just corporate lobbyists. Let's be honest what they are. They're the pencil pushers who write the language and make the loopholes so these big multinational corporations can control not only business, but government. So heaven forbid that you want to pass let's say a Buy American provision, which I know a lot of people are in favor of. I'm in huge favor of local procurement. Like if the state of Pennsylvania wants to buy Penn State shirts, shouldn't they be sewn or printed here in Pennsylvania? Just a thought. If we want to pave our roads, shouldn't the cement or the asphalt be made right here? Shouldn't that be how it works? If we're going to put big bridges up, shouldn't the steel come from Pennsylvania? Well, these trade deals go through. Good luck doing that. Done deal. Not happening. And if you do that, you'll be sued in the tribunal, and you'll have to pay. Did you hear that? I mean, I think it's super important that we understand that this trade deal, all of these insane neoliberal trade deals that we've been getting screwed with for years, NAFTA's now 20 years old. Didn't they tell us, it's going to rise all boats, everyone's going to do better? Is everyone doing better? No. In fact, I would argue everyone is doing worse. Everyone who punches a clock, everyone who does an hour of work is doing that much worse. Now, understand, the people sitting at the top of the corner office, with the glass windows looking down on the rest of us, they're doing wildly well, never better. Life is wonderful at the top. But like most things, it rolls downhill. And it's not the wonderful rivers of gold and honey that we were promised would trickle down economics. It's a yellow substance, all right. But it's not coming from Winnie the Pooh's honey pot. It's coming a little bit further south. What this trade deal is going to do, you know it. It's lower wages. It's about, let's get the cheapest, most exploitable labor we can possibly get, which means we're going to lose more manufacturing jobs. We're going to lose more jobs, period. And we're going to have more things dumped here because we're the consumer of last resort, which means higher trade deficits and also higher debt because people are going to buy stuff as we've been with credit cards. It's just what it is. But beyond the job loss and the wage loss comes all of the other nastiness. The attacks on our environmental laws. Oh, sorry, you can't have that. It's a violation of the trade agreement's least restrictive trade barrier. We can't regulate Wall Street. We can't regulate anything anymore then. Because basically what you're saying is if it's a barrier to trade, if it's a barrier, if one country doesn't do it, then none of them can. And we don't even get to use our courts. I mean, that's the thing that gets me. They take, you're giving, for all of my Tea Party people, all of the right-wing freedom fighters, if you will, people who hide out in the woods and do the right-wing militia thing, they're stealing your sovereignty. You want to know who's really stealing your sovereignty? It's not Obama's health care. It's none of that. It's these trade deals. And these trade deals are bipartisan. Understand, when you go back to NAFTA, NAFTA was not Bill Clinton's dream child. He didn't dream it up. It was dreamt up under the Reagan years. Actually, it was dreamt up before Reagan, but Reagan's administration began to negotiate the NAFTA treaty. Then H.W. Bush came in and did all the heavy lifting, did all the work. Bill Clinton took office and said, well, you know, we got to make people think that we're not going to stick it to them really hard, so let's throw in some toothless labor restrictions and some toothless environmental laws so it looks like we put some dressing around, you know, just to spruce it up, put a little lipstick on the pig, if you will. And they rammed it through, told us, oh, it's going to be good for everyone. Can anyone make an argument that NAFTA has been good for the country? Can anyone in Mexico make an argument that NAFTA has been good for Mexico? The answer is no. And we have been running massive trade deficits with the rest of the world. So I go back to this, and I first and foremost, you've got to get on the phone, light up the phones to your representatives. I don't care who they are. Democrat, Republican, Independent, Communist, Socialist, Fascist, I don't care. Say, no fast track. Do your job. do your job. Because if these trade deals saw the light of day, if this saw the light of day, and this is what gets me, this is what angers and frustrates me. Look, I voted for Obama, and for the most part, I support many of the policies that he puts forth. And as you know, if you listen to this program long enough, there are a lot of things I don't support. This is one of them. And this is a massive one of them. Because this means millions of jobs lost. This means a lower standard of living, not just for us here, but globally. This idea that, oh, we're going to raise up the Vietnamese standard of living is ludicrous. Because what's going to happen, it's like the albatross around your neck. It's going to pull us down. And there's so much more to this that, you know, you're just going to continue to see this race to the bottom, this massive push towards more inequality, a gulf larger between those who have and those who don't, and fewer numbers of those who have. I mean, it's interesting you see the stratification at the very top even. Because, you know, you can say, oh, you're a 1%er, but it's not even the 1%. You don't get into the club being in the 1%. You only get into the club if you're in the 100th of 1%, the handful. You know, those 199 people on the first day of the year who paid absolutely everything they're going to pay into Social Security for the entire 365-day year. And maybe even those 900 people to 1,000, remember around 900 to 1,000 people who on day two paid everything that they're going to pay into Social Security. They're generally the ones who are saying, well, what we need to do is cut Social Security. That's how we save it. Take from you and, of course, well, give to us. Haven't you had enough yet? Aren't you ready to stand up, raise your voice, say, nonsense. Call BS when BS is needed to be called. And this, folks, massive, huge, steaming piles of BS. And if you think for one second that this trade deal is going to stop the next fiasco on Wall Street, you need to think again. This trade deal could make that worse, and not just only on Wall Street. We almost brought the entire globe down in 2008. And in fact, we did. Be honest what it is. Europe, Greece and Spain and those countries, they were heading downward. We hastened their demise in a huge way. Thanks to that collapse. Now by making Wall Streets and these big banks bigger and more influential and more powerful globally, what happens the next time? That's why we have got to, with every shred of our fiber and being, stop this fast-track authority. And look, I don't care who it is. I don't care if it's a Democrat or Republican. I don't care who is it. You don't get fast-track. Learn the lesson. Don't do it again. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. According to a new poll from Quinnipiac University, Americans support raising the minimum wage by 71% to 27%. The poll also finds Americans support extending unemployment benefits by 58% to 37%. 51% of people polled think the minimum wage should be raised to $10.10 an hour or higher. Consideration is underway in the U.S. Senate right now to extend jobless benefits by 3 months. A new Americans United for Change national ad features some workers who are losing their unemployment benefits.
I lost my job probably 6-7 months ago.
I'm a year short of being qualifying for my retirement.
They had some cutbacks. I was the most skilled technician and also the highest paid. My retirement is going away as a result of this.
I do have a husband. Thank God. Or I would be homeless.
Tell Republicans, restore unemployment benefits now.
I was completely blown away by how many signatures we've gotten.
A Change.org petition launched by an anonymous Staples worker has gathered more than 166,000 signatures calling on Staples to stop dodging legal requirements of the Affordable Care Act by cutting part-time hours of its workers. A worker using the pseudonym Sue Whistleblower worked for years between 30 and 35 hours a week at Staples, but starting last month, Sue and other Staples workers had their hours cut back to just 25 hours a week with no exceptions. Sue believes that Staples did it to avoid having to provide health insurance coverage to the workers under the Affordable Care Act.
I just want to thank the folks that have signed our petition at change.org. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You know, this is definitely sending a clear message that Staples and other companies like this cannot abuse their workers and abuse loopholes just because they can and just to save money. And hopefully we will send a clear message. If they abuse their employees, people will take their money elsewhere.
Sue says the Affordable Care Act is working, despite efforts by Staples and others to sabotage it.
As convoluted as the process was, it worked. And I'm hoping to get my new insurance cards here shortly.
Public employees in New York City are entering new contract talks, feeling no longer demonized by the mayor. New Mayor Bill de Blasio is perceived as being much more worker-friendly than multi-billionaire Mike Bloomberg was. The unions in New York City say that a whole different tone is being set by the new mayor. The unions told New York City's Labor Press that the union-city relationship is going to be reset based on honesty, respect, and a shared commitment to making the city work. The 300,000 New York City public workers haven't had raises in years. The unions estimate city workers have lost a combined total of $6 to $7 billion. Nobody is expecting the contract talks to be easy, but the unions believe that the new de Blasio administration will be an effective and progressive one that respects workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I am so pleased to be your governor, and I ask you to give me your support as I run for governor again, because I am running for governor of Pennsylvania.
Well, you know, he may be pleased to be the governor, but not many people here in the Commonwealth are pleased that he is. In fact, an approval rating, somewhere I've seen numbers 24 to 36% approval rating. What I find interesting is his campaign manager, this guy Mike Barley, actually reaching out to Chris Christie. Look, really, isn't Christie having enough problems of his own? It's pretty bad when a guy who's sinking is someone that you're reaching out towards. And now, understand, Christie is the chairman of the Republican Governors Association, so he's going to be doing some running around the country, stumping for the gubernatorial candidates in 2014. But really, I guess if your numbers are 24 to 36%, I guess you'll grab onto anything, even if it is something that is heading downward. And I don't know if you've been following the Bridgegate or Bridgegazi, but it seems very punitive and, well, what I think I would expect from people that would be around the Christie camp. Anyway, on Wednesday, the Democratic Policy Committee held a hearing on the Medicaid expansion. And as I've been saying, this is a no-brainer to me, and I have no idea why the governor hadn't taken it already so that we could have this in place January 1st so we could start covering his constituents. And if you really wanted to jump those approval ratings, getting people health care would probably be a good place to start. But we've asked Pennsylvania State Representative Mary Jo Daly to come talk to us. She's on the policy committee, I guess, attended the big policy hearing. Mary Jo, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
I got to be honest, it makes absolutely no sense to me that this governor would not take the money, especially given the frame that he's running around saying he's the more jobs governor, because this would create somewhere 30, 40,000 new jobs. That could be the feather in the cap.
That's right, Rick. It could be the feather in the cap. And I think many of us, or most of us at the hearing on Wednesday, were of the same mind that you are, that why are we not taking this?
Is it an ideological thing? I mean, you're closer to this than I am. What's the governor saying, the reason that he's not taking the money? Because it seems free money for 3 years and then 90% free from there on out seems like a no-brainer to anybody.
To most people it does, but what I hear is concern that the federal government will change you know, they'll bring everybody in and then they'll change the rules and they will not come through with the money.
But then you can opt out, right?
Then you can opt out.
So it seems like a no-lose situation.
You would think that it's a no-lose situation. And even the governor's Healthy PA plan, we actually talked about that on Wednesday also. And, you know, that would make people wait until at least January of 2015 if it's even approved. And people who testified said that he could have gone on with the Medicaid expansion just the way it is right now and continue to work on the changes that he wants through this waiver process. He's got 23 waivers in the draft plan at this point. And I asked the question because I didn't know what other states were doing. Was that an unusually large number of waivers, or was that a typical number of waivers? And we were told that that was a large number, that typically there may be, you know, 3 to 5 waiver requests. So it's a big ask that he's putting in this Healthy PA with no guarantee and not to start for 12 months.
So, I got to tell you, Mary Jo, I love that name. And, you know, I've dusted off my copy of 1984 and just kind of to go back and learn double speak and the Orwellian speak. Healthy PA, you're not going to get health care, even if we get it for an entire year. That to me just the epitome of Orwellian speak.
I would agree completely. I would agree because it's written as though it's, you know, they want to make people healthy and focused on their health and have behavioral changes. But, you know, we're talking about not taking advantage of getting insurance for in the range of 500,000 Pennsylvanians.
And those are 5,000 potential votes.
500,000.
That's what I mean, 500,000.
Well, it isn't 500,000 votes. You're right, though, because although it could be because...
Oh, those children. Oh, we don't care about children.
Children would already be covered. Children there is coverage for. So
okay.
It is mostly adults. But the thing is that, you know, you want the whole family to have insurance.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at this, and maybe this is just my jaded political view, I thought when this came out that this was a stalling technique. You're going to throw out all of this stuff. A lot of it we already know has been turned down in other states. That this is just a, hey, I'm looking at it, I'm considering it. It's a political year, so he's got to at least pander and attempt to make it look like he cares. To me, it just looks like a stalling technique that once the election's over, if he wins, he chucks the whole thing. And as you've pointed out, 500,000 people left out in the cold.
Absolutely. And you know, these are people with jobs for the most part. They're in that area. I mean, the reason that they wanted to include a Medicaid expansion with the Affordable Care Act was because that they knew that there were going to be people who would not be making enough money to go on to the exchange to buy their insurance. And then there are the folks who get Medicaid. So in between those two groups, that's where these folks sit. They can't, they make too much money to get Medicaid. They don't make enough to get onto the health exchange. And there's about 500 to 650,000 of those individuals. And the point is Medicaid expansion is that the state's because of the Supreme Court ruling,
right,
and our state is not doing it. And there are, at this point, I think 25 states who have opted in. And Iowa, Michigan, they both went through the waiver process. But the waiver process is even the more difficult way. There are other ways that you can go into it without going through the waiver process. So it does seem as though we have picked the most difficult path.
Why doesn't that surprise me? And, you know, here's the thing, Mary Jo. We spoke the other night with Jim Wilshire, one of the folks who testified before your committee. He is the director of policy and partnership over at the Pennsylvania Association of Community Health Centers. And
yes,
when we were talking to him, I said, what happens if you don't get the money? What happens to organizations like yours? What happens to your local emergency room if you're talking about this huge number of working poor who don't get insurance? What happens if they don't get it? What happens to your emergency room and your health centers? And he said, huge trouble.
Absolutely. You know, but it doesn't make any sense. The day following, on Thursday, there was a hearing on minimum wage. And when you look one of the things that occurred to me after having sat at the Medicaid expansion was that if we were to increase the minimum wage, you would actually potentially, not for sure, but potentially people would make enough money that they'd be able to get their insurance through the exchange. So there's another, you know, kind of interesting situation. These are people who are working at jobs that they don't have benefits and they're not making enough money.
I'm right with there with you. I've been saying for years we need to raise the minimum wage, and a little later on in the program we're going to talk with Dr. Mark Price from the Keystone Research Center about the minimum wage issue, because I think here again, it's an extremely important issue, but my problem with it is 2006, last time we raised it, and we have to go these 5, 6, 7, 8 years, maybe this one will take longer, to get just a meager increase. And in that time frame, what's end up happening is inflation just erodes it away, and we end up seeing more people falling into poverty, more people who are working. And that really goes against what I think the Republicans say they stand for, is this meritocracy-based society where if you work and you play by the rules, you succeed and get ahead. I'm just not seeing it with the pathetic minimum wage we now have.
No, I'm not seeing it either. And Dr. Price was actually, he testified at the minimum wage hearing also, so he was very interesting. And one of the suggestions that other states have done is they've actually indexed, I guess indexing is the right word, but they've tied an increase, in, you know, a more automatic increase. Because it's clearly more difficult to do this kind of thing when you have to have a whole big discussion.
Yep.
But if you do it as a matter of course, you know, then you can get it done and people stay more current with what they're earning.
It's what I was screaming for in 2006 on this program. Let's get it done and do it right. But instead, and what I love about what happened in 2006, instead the Republicans demanded their pound of flesh, which means that any municipality, any city, any township, anyone who wanted to have a local minimum wage ordinance to raise their minimum wage, in 2006 they made it illegal.
I'm not surprised.
Just like Seth Grove is trying to do right now with paid sick days or paid vacation days. He wants to pass a law that says the city of Philadelphia or Pittsburgh or where I live in Carlisle, you can't have that kind of an ordinance. They would make it illegal. But what I find odd about that is these are the people who tell me they want government out of our lives and off our backs, less intrusive, smaller government. But every time I turn around, they're sticking their government in my back.
Absolutely. You have it. That's exactly what's happening.
Go ahead.
I'm just thinking that, you know, we see this in a variety of different areas. So, you know, coming from Montgomery County in Pennsylvania, we have, you know, more Democratic local governments. We have a Democratic county commission majority at this point. It's very strange to sit there and be in the minority again, because, you know, if you're from the Southeast, you get a little bit used to being in charge and doing things, and one of the difficulties is being in the minority again.
Here's the thing that bothers me. You know, you go back to this, and like I said, these are the people who the Republican-controlled legislature, and then pretty much the ideology of the Republican Party is smaller, less intrusive government, like they say. But like I said, every time I turn around, they're jabbing me in the back. And I understand right now there are several pieces of legislation, one being 1507, that's going to screw public sector workers by taking away their ability to bargain with their employer over dues checkoff, and then right to work is next on the line. And I'm going, you know, at what point do you stop saying we care about, you know, we want smaller government, when every time I turn around, they're jabbing me with it?
No, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. It's mind-boggling at times how many ways. And plus the fact that we consider quite a number of bills where we're increasing penalties where people could have, or jail time. I mean, it's, and we're already spending a fortune in supporting the prison. So it makes it really difficult because, you know, you're in a position where you don't, it's hard to vote on some of these things. Do you know what I mean?
No, I hear you. And I got to look, I've had a number of legislators on this program, and I give you guys and women nothing but the ultimate respect and credit, because I got to be honest, if I sat across from Darrell Metcalf or Stephen Bloom or any of these people pushing the poison that they're pushing on society, I'd probably strangle them, and then I'd be in prison.
Well, you have to remember that they got I mean, my own trick is that I just try to remember they got there the same way I did. The people in their district voted for them. Okay. I have to, you know, and then you look for ways to get along.
Yeah, but you got to wonder how many of the people know how much what kind of poison they're pushing. This assault on prevailing wage, this assault on workers' rights to me, and I don't think enough people understand how venomous it is and who benefits. You know, I always ask the question, to whose benefit is this right to work law? To whose benefit would 1507 be? And you got to go back to Wall Street, the Koch brothers, the big money special interest. Because it's sure not me, Mary Jo. It's sure not my neighbors. It's not my family. We're the ones who are being hurt by it.
Look, I grew up in a union family, and we understood that this was a good thing. My father used to tell us that the union put the bread and butter on the table for us. And my mother, you know, had us down at the food distribution center in Philadelphia picketing for the United States. You know, the grape workers or the farm workers. And we never ate lettuce, iceberg lettuce, and we didn't eat grapes in our house for a long time. So
I know it.
You know, I understand. And but that's part of the reason that I wanted to go to Harrisburg, to be one of the voices, hopefully, of sanity and somebody to stick up for people.
Thank you. So let me ask you this. You know, when you come back on Monday, I understand this. Are you hearing that this stuff has got legs, that it's a possibility that, I mean, with everything else that has to be done, with all the work that's left undone, to spend the time, the energy, waste the money. I mean, you look at the money that they've wasted on lottery and liquor privatization and all of these schemes that they could have been putting into education and health care and all the time we should be fixing our economy, not making it worse. It just seems to me to be a horrible distraction and a waste of time.
I would agree.
So are you seeing that this is a possibility? Because, you know, I'm a little uneasy.
You mean Medicaid expansion or what?
The right to work.
Oh. I don't remember if that's in the state government committee, but we have a state government voting meeting. I am on that committee. We have that meeting on Wednesday, and there are just land conveyances. So I'm not seeing that.
Okay.
And you know, if it's not in state government and it's not in a committee that I'm on, then I'm not.
Right. I just
wanted
to know
exactly what the calendar is.
I just wanted to, you know, I've talked to a couple other legislators who said they're hearing whispers. I want to be in front of it because I want my listeners to know this is pure poison. This means lower wages, less health care, less benefits, a lower standard of living for people in this Commonwealth. It's pure poison.
I appreciate what you're doing because I think it's really important because I think, you know, people don't always know what's going on in Harrisburg, and we try to keep them up to date on it, but you know, I quite honestly, I haven't heard that. I've been focused on Medicaid expansion and minimum wage.
All right, so last line of questioning then. Sure. Back to the Medicaid expansion. How do we get this? How do we get the pressure put forth to get this pushed through? Because look, there are 500,000 plus people in this Commonwealth who go to work every day and bust their behind, and they're going to end up getting the shaft because of this governor. What do we do?
Well, I think that people have to keep writing to the governor, calling the governor, you know, coming out to Harrisburg and making it very clear that they think that this is an important thing to get done, that people should be insured. The money is there. There are ways to set it up that, you know, we can get out of it if it turns out to be a really bad deal. But that, you know, I think peer pressure, you know, pressure from voters, constituents. It's an election year.
I'm right there with you. When they think their head can be on a stick, maybe they turn the right way. Representative Mary Jo Daly, I appreciate the time. It was great talking with you. We'd love to have you back again soon.
That would be terrific, Rick. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Quick break. Your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Beat up cars with the tires and drummers go.
Blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. Fox News can't seem to talk about the Chris Christie bridge closure scandal without invoking Benghazi. Fox and Friends devoted 5 segments to the story Friday morning and somehow managed to bring up the September 2012 Benghazi attacks in each segment. But it wasn't just Fox. Here's Rush Limbaugh on Thursday.
We're spending now an hour press conference on Lane closures on the George Washington Bridge. We haven't spent this much time in a press conference on four Americans dying in Benghazi.
And Laura Ingraham.
Why would we even comment about this Chris Christie issue? To even go on and on about this story, raising other issues, when we have four Americans dead in Benghazi, after the administration said, well, basically, what does it matter?
Media Matters has crafted a how-to checklist for conservative media covering the scandal. To check it out, please visit MediaMatters.org.
For generations, picture takers have instructed their subjects to say cheese. Well, no people say cheese better than Wisconsinites, who unabashedly wear cheesehead hats in public, celebrate dozens of cheese festivals, have a Monterey Jack bacterium as the state's official microbe, and generally honor the milk curd as a deity. So naturally, Wisconsin would be the state to come up with the idea of spraying its city streets with cheese brine. This is not some sort of cheesy tourist promotion, but an actual attempt to have two problems blend into one clever solution. Problem number one is ice. Wisconsin gets lots of it, with Milwaukee alone averaging more than 4 feet of snow each winter and spending some $10 million a year to apply rock salt to clear its frozen streets. Not only is that a lot of money, but about 30% of the dry salt bounces off the roadways and pollutes waterways. Problem number two is cheese brine. It's a waste product from cheese making, and this state produces nearly 3 billion pounds of cheese a year, so it has lots of brine. It costs a typical dairy farmer thousands of dollars each year to dispose of it. But this winter, farmers are donating their waste problem to cities like Milwaukee, which are hauling the brine to their road maintenance facilities and blending it into the rock salt. The idea is to create a mixture with just the right stickiness to keep the salt from bouncing away. You want to use provolone or mozzarella, says a Milwaukee Public Works manager. Those have the best salt content. You have to do practically nothing to it. This is Jim Hightower saying, voila, two messes equal a neat solution. Wisconsin officials still consider their cheese-coated streets an experiment, but it seems to be working out just fine. And it's just one example of a myriad of innovative alternatives being produced by local governments all across our country.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
By working harder and working smarter, working with the employees in the Commonwealth, we made state government the smallest it has been in over 50 years. Promise kept.
We who have nothing, and most likely will too, we all end up locked up in jail by conservative Christian, right-wing Republican, straight white American man.
Oh, yes, mission accomplished. Promise kept. Yeah, we kicked 41,000 low-wage workers off at the adult basic. Promise kept. We kicked 89,000 kids off the CHIP program. Promise kept. We eliminated the general assistance budget for 70,000 of the most vulnerable in our state. Promise kept. Yeah, kept a lot of promises. Although, I got to be honest, I don't remember hearing any of those promises on the campaign trail. None of them. But, you know, those were promises that were made, much like Mitt Romney did with the 47% video. When nobody was looking and the funders were going, you're going to make us some promises. We'll give you some money, but you got to make us some promises that you're going to get after them lazy people. Push them into the workforce. Oh, but they're already in the workforce. That's okay. Make them work two jobs. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, give me a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Interested in your thoughts on a number of these things. I mean, it's just the fact that this guy won't take the Medicaid expansion money just blows my mind. And, you know, we play a clip every once in a while. It says, well, you'll be the Texas of the Northeast. Pennsylvania will be the Texas of the Northeast. And I've been talking about this restaurant owner who one of his employees had a rash on her leg, went to the hospital, found out it was a blood clot. They did a CT scan, MRI, figured out that she had a tumor. Now the guy's going, you know, hey, we're going to sell the restaurant. We're going to sell the restaurant so we can help this 19-year-old girl get the health care that she needs. How insane is that? But, Rick, we're being business friendly. No, we're not. We're being stupid. This girl should have been able to just go to the doctor, get it taken care of. And the business owner, because you want to be business friendly, give the business owner certainty that his employees will be fine. That's the way to go with this. It's absolutely mind-blowing to me. And the other part of this is the costs of health care. The idea in this, and there have been a number of studies out there that have already said that the Affordable Care Act has done what it was supposed to do. It has slowed the rate of growth and the cost, the increase in costs of health care. It has done that. There's a lot more we should be doing. And there's part of me that goes, you know, maybe we need to open up the borders and get us some more doctors, because there's a stranglehold on the number of doctors we can have in our society, thanks to the AMA, the American Medical Association, and the stranglehold to the universities have and how many doctors they train, which is very interesting to me. I mean, you would think as a nation that we could go, okay, we need more doctors. We're going to, through some incentive, if you're smart enough, you've got the grades, and you can make it through, you know what? We need more general practitioners. We want 100,000 more practitioners, and we're going to pay all of your bills. All you have to do is go through it and make it through and do what you need to do and be willing to practice in areas where we need general practitioners. But we're not doing that. And we're not doing it enough. I mean, I look at Cuba, and you could say what you want about Cuba. Cuba has a pretty good healthcare system. In fact, they train so many doctors that they trade doctors for oil. They trade doctors for food. They trade doctors for things that they need. It's amazing. It's one of their commodities. It's absolutely amazing to me. During the break, John sent me this email that points out that, because I've talked about the cost of healthcare in the past, and when my daughter broke her arm. You know, I was doing the good dad thing. I said, well, let's go to the park and play. We'll spend the afternoon playing together. We weren't there 2 minutes. She goes and does kind of a weird swing thing on the parallel bars, flips off the side, lands on her arm, breaks her elbow. So we go to the doctor, and I'm frazzled. It's one of those moments, and I'm sure any parent who's been in that situation knows, because I'm feeling horrible. There's nothing I can do. And she looks at me with these teary, sad eyes, and why did you have to take me to the park? I'll never forget that as long as I live. Like, it was my fault she fell, and it was, because I shouldn't have been the good dad. I should have been evil and made her clean her room. But we go to the hospital, and we're there for, like, forever in the emergency room. For-profit hospital. They fix her arm. They do a whole bunch of stuff. And it's this long 8.5-hour day. I get the bill. And the bill for a broken arm was $12,000. Between the hospital stay, the doctor, and all of the stuff that went in. 12 grand. That's what they were going to bill me. My insurance company, I think, paid about $1,800, which is just ludicrous. It used to be, if you were paying cash, they gave you a discount. Now it's the other way around. These big networks, they negotiate their volume buying and stick it to people paying cash. Well, there was this 20-year-old guy in the email that put his bill online. A 20-year-old guy needed some health care. I almost can't get it out. He had very basic surgery. For, I think it was an appendicitis. And he, overall, the whole bill was $55,000 for an appendicitis. And they adjusted it down, and they said that you can make monthly payments, and you need to pay, I think it was like $10,000 or something immediately. And it's amazing that when the insurance paid it, it was like $11,000. But if he would have paid it out of his pocket, it would have been like 55 grand. And that's what these insurance companies have done. They've made these situations that are just outrageous, that you couldn't possibly pay it on your own. Now, this kid putting this online spurred a whole bunch of stories. A Canadian mother, a woman who had foot surgery, She was charged $60 for foot surgery. I'm not sure what it was, but she was in the hospital a couple of days, had foot surgery. She was charged $60 for cable TV. A guy in Malaysia had an appendectomy. He paid the equivalent of $25. And you go down the list of all of these places that where healthcare is something that is a right, something that people demand from their government. And they get care. And it's reasonable. Here, there's another story of a girl who got sick. They took her to the emergency room. And in the emergency room for like 8 hours, they got a juice box and some kind of pill to make an anti-nausea pill. Cost $2,000. You figure that out, because I can't. So there's a lot we need to be doing with healthcare. And for me, this Medicaid expansion is just the first start of it. But we got a governor who, no, not going to do it. And I really believe this whole healthy PA thing, this Orwellian speak, is all about stall and delay. All about knowing that the feds are never going to give him out all of his waivers. And it's just getting him through the election so he can say, well, we're working on it. And then afterwards, screw you people. Just like he said with adult basic, just like he said with the CHIP program. Screw you working people. That's why I got to tell you, come November, got to go. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. While the poor man pays the band, oh, they're filling me. All killing me. Lord, have mercy on the working man.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2nd, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began the first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized the renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Month was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.thericksmithshow.com.
prevailing wage was actually discriminatory when it started. I don't think we need to go into the full history of that, but it was definitely meant to keep construction projects local. And we are now in pretty much of a global economy.
The scary thing about that guy is the chairman of the House Labor Committee, Chairman Ron Miller. He's the chairman. He's the head guy. He's the guy who decides what gets pushed through. Understand what he just said. And I got to be honest, I agree 100% with the premise that it was meant to be kept local. We wanted to encourage local crafts. We wanted to encourage local employment. Abso-freaking-lutely. Don't you, honestly, don't you want to make sure that the building that your kid sits in is built by people who live in the neighborhood, who their kids probably sit in that building too? Don't you want the roads to be built by local people? Don't you want all of the money that you're spending on investing in infrastructure to be staying in your neighborhood, recirculating through your local economy? Don't you? I do, and maybe I'm crazy. I don't know. But I'll tell you. I want local. I want the people right there. Wow. Here's some interesting news. Might make you happy. While everyone was focused on Chris Christie and the Bridge Ghazi and Bridgegate, House Republicans passed the Reducing Excessive Deadline Obligation Act. And you go, wow, what's that, Rick? They were amendments to the Solid Waste Disposal Act and the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, commonly known as Superfund. Basically, if you don't dispose of something properly, you have spills, you have to pay to clean it up. And there are rules and regulations in place for you to do that. What I just find it really interesting. Basically a party line vote, 225 to 188. You had four Republicans who voted against it, five Democrats who voted for it. But there's the thing that gets me. On the same day that in West Virginia they're having uncontrollable vomiting if you drank the water, on the same day that they had the Freedom Industries spill into the American waterways, and 300,000 people now without water, can't even brush their teeth. And now they've declared a state of emergency. Isn't that beautiful? We don't need no stinking regulations. Guess it's just how it is. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. I got Preston on line one. How you doing tonight, Preston?
I'm doing well, man. I wanted to call and wish you a happy new year. And
back at you, brother.
Yeah. And thanks for informing me about Pennsylvania. I was just telling your screener that I was born in Philadelphia. And it, you know, breaks my heart to see this class war going on and, you know, against the teachers and so much of the common good.
Yeah, anybody who works, you're on the menu because we're not sitting at the table anymore because we're on the menu.
That's right. That's right. So, but thankfully there's a fair amount of, you know, people organizing out there. I don't know if you know the work of Diane Ravitch.
Yep. She does fantastic work. We've had her on the program, and I think everyone should read her book.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I just posted a talk of hers on your Facebook page.
Terrific.
And, she came by Denver a couple months ago and spoke to a lot of teachers' associations. Sadly, there was a Democratic state senator named Edie Hudak who introduced her, and about 2 months later, the right wing had mobilized their gun fanatics, and they threatened a recall against Evie Hudak, and she ended up just resigning so that the Democrats could keep their seats. So they play hard.
Absolutely.
And they're well organized. But again, I see other people playing well too. You know, we don't have their money, we don't have their media, but we have very interesting projects going on at the grassroots. And did you happen to notice that socialists get elected in Seattle?
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope that they move on what they say they're going to move on, a $15 minimum wage.
That's right.
And start talking about the populist message that look, yeah, the American people, the American workers, the people in this country want. It's just they're not hearing it. You know, the Politico just did a piece recently that said, you know, the left and progressives and just average everyday working people have the right message. They just don't have any microphone or any megaphone to get that message out, and they're being drowned out by these well-funded insaniacs on the right.
Yeah. And, yeah, they don't have the big megaphone, that's for sure. They don't have the Wizard of Oz kind of apparatus of the corporate aristocracy, but they do have a lot of little microphones. Yours is one. You know, what Bob is doing is another. Some other progressive media efforts. YouTube has been, I think, an opening for a lot of labor interests, and I think some labor groups could utilize it even better.
Yeah. As I've always said, they may have more money. They may be able to outspend us, but we've outprocreated them. There are more of us. If we get out, we get in the streets, we get our feet in the streets, we raise our voices, we raise our heads and our hands, we can change things.
I hear you, man. Right on. I'm actually a proud government worker here in Colorado.
Oh, you're one of those.
Are they
trying to steal your pension out in Colorado like they're trying to do here in Pennsylvania?
You know, there is a right-wing radio host who rails against it. He's going after it ideologically all the time. His name is Mike Rosen. Very sophisticated. He's one of the best kind of debaters, I'd say. But he goes after it ideologically. But we've had some allies in the government so far. But there are definitely issues and jobs being trimmed away and you know, things going on. I'm involved with Colorado Winds.
Right.
And they make their efforts. And so we'll see where it goes. It's been interesting, though. Some jobs have been created recently in the government.
And
that's
should
because,
be.
Yeah, to do, you know, different services. I'd love to see an expanded, you know, renewable energy segment of the government and mass transit get a ton of money. But they did have to create a new marijuana administration agency, as you might imagine.
Cheech and Chong, the head of that?
Exactly. I mean, they sold like $5 million of cannabis in the first week.
Wow.
And they've been hiring people. And you know, they're not the most, I don't know, the jobs themselves can be very interesting. At other times, they can be very dull. But I don't know. I think a lot of people are kind of proud to work in this industry. I think some of its workers probably need to organize themselves.
Yeah.
There are these temp agencies that are already started around, like hemp temps is one of them.
Yeah, I'm going to talk a little bit about that later on in the program.
Okay.
Because you know we had the temp talk a couple of days ago, and I got a couple of emails on that. But I got to take a break, Preston. I appreciate the call. It's great call.
Great chat with you.
Please call back anytime.
Will do. Thank you, Rick. Right on. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much. No, I mean, he's spot on. And I'm of the mindset, healthcare.gov, privatization run amok. And thank goodness they fired that private firm. Quick break. Right back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
According to a new poll from Quinnipiac University, Americans support raising the minimum wage by 71% to 27%. The poll also finds Americans support extending unemployment benefits by 58% to 37%. 51% of people polled think the minimum wage should be raised to $10.10 an hour or higher. Consideration is underway in the U.S. Senate right now to extend jobless benefits by 3 months. A new Americans United for Change national ad features some workers who are losing their unemployment benefits.
I lost my job probably about 6-7 months ago.
I'm a year short of being qualifying for my retirement.
They had some cutbacks. I was the most skilled technician and also the highest paid. My retirement is going away as a result of this.
I do have a husband. Thank God. Or I would be homeless.
Tell Republicans, restore unemployment benefits now.
I was completely blown away by how many signatures we've gotten.
A Change.org petition launched by an anonymous Staples worker has gathered more than 166,000 signatures calling on Staples to stop dodging legal requirements of the Affordable Care Act by cutting part-time hours of its workers. A worker using the pseudonym Sue Whistleblower worked for years between 30 and 35 hours a week at Staples, but starting last month, Sue and other Staples workers had their hours cut back to just 25 hours a week with no exceptions. Sue believes that Staples did it to avoid having to provide health insurance coverage to the workers under the Affordable Care Act.
I just want to thank the folks that have signed our petition at change.org. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You know, this is definitely sending a clear message that Staples and other companies like this cannot abuse their workers and abuse loopholes just because they can and just to save money. And hopefully we will send a clear message. If they abuse their employees, people will take their money elsewhere.
Sue says the Affordable Care Act is working, despite efforts by Staples and others to sabotage it.
As convoluted as the process was, it worked, and I'm hoping to get my new insurance cards here shortly.
Public employees in New York City are entering new contract talks, feeling no longer demonized by the mayor. New Mayor Bill de Blasio is perceived as being much more worker-friendly than multi-billionaire Mike Bloomberg was. The unions in New York City say that a whole different tone is being set by the new mayor. The unions told New York City's labor press that the union-city relationship is going to be reset based on honesty, respect, and a shared commitment to making the city work. The 300,000 New York City public workers haven't had raises in years. The unions estimate city workers have lost a combined total of $6 to $7 billion. Nobody is expecting the contract talks to be easy, but the unions believe that the new de Blasio administration will be an effective and progressive one that respects workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Guess what? The majority of the American people believe we should have a gold standard, not a paper standard.
Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows. Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows. Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows.
Oh, yes. Big fluffy unicorns. I miss Ron Paul. I got to be honest. I miss the insanity. That's simple. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So the other day, this guy, Arthur Laffer, came up with the curve. Former Reagan economist, came up with a lot of bad policy there. Said that the minimum wage was the Black Teenager Unemployment Act. And, you know, he goes there because no employer wants to take a chance on those people at $7.25 an hour. In fact, the guy from the American Enterprise Institute, their resident scholar, a guy named Michael Strain, he said the minimum wage should be lowered to $4 an hour because, of course, you know, employers might be more willing to take a chance on those people at $4 an hour. And I asked the question, well, why not just make it, you know, cheese crackers or soda? Work for soda. How low will it go? Well, here to help us work through the minimum wage question, our good friend Mark Price, labor economist over at the Keystone Research Center, keystoneresearch.org, the website. Mark, what do you think? Cheese crackers?
Hey, cheese and crackers.
There you go.
For everyone.
That's your wage for the day.
Yes, but please work hard. Don't make us whip you.
What do you think of this statement by Arthur Laffer? I mean, other than the racial component, it just sounds stupid.
Yeah, well, Arthur is not an expert in this field. He's, you know, he's famous because, you know, he's an advisor to politicians, not because he's an actual experienced economist who does empirical work. And you know, really, one of the things to keep in mind is that, and something that actually makes me quite happy and hopeful about the future. And I know that's going to sound strange, but economists generally, Rick, and you know this better than anyone, economists generally aren't nice people, all right? I mean, you know, economists generally come down the pike with a lot of recommendations that are terrible. Sometimes they sound terrible. Sometimes they are genuinely really terrible. But what's happened really in the past couple of decades is the opinion in the economic discipline has shifted sharply in the opposite view of Dr. Laffer's argument, and that is that increasingly a majority of economists argue that modest increases in the minimum wage in the range of $1 to $2 do not have any negative employment impact. Not only do they not have overall negative employment impacts, but when you look at those vulnerable groups of workers, teenagers, for instance, the folks you think would be most likely to be impacted by a minimum wage increase, careful research has not been able to identify substantial negative employment impact.
There's the problem. Careful research.
Well, but what I think the point and why I'm hopeful, right, is that it's that research really that has shifted, you know, opinion in the economic discipline. And, you know, facts don't matter, right? You know that better than anyone. Power matters. But in these debates, you got to have a public fight. And I think increasingly the minimum wage is an issue where the momentum is moving decidedly in our favor in terms of raising it. You know, we've had several states raise minimum wage, New York, New Jersey among them. Ohio, the minimum wage rose by just 10 cents. But, you know, Ohio has this advantage that voter referendum passed an inflation adjustment to the minimum wage so that over time, Ohio workers, unlike Pennsylvania workers, don't lose purchasing power as prices increase. So you get very modest 10 cents an hour or less increases in the Ohio minimum wage over time. It helps those folks not fall behind. That's a good policy. So, and we're seeing this, you know, break out across the country, strikes in fast food restaurants. You covered all of these issues over the last summer. And so I think really momentum is behind us. Not to say in Pennsylvania, we don't face rather substantial obstacles, among them Governor Corbett. But, you know, I think really we are on the fight, and I think that's important and hopeful.
Yeah, I think the reality is that most people, and I've seen a lot of polling on this, the good majority of people are in favor of raising it because I think people get that meritocracy argument the Republicans like to make but never really quite live up to, that if you work hard, you play by the rules, you should be able to put a roof over your head and a meal on the table and be able to support yourself without having to ask for food stamps or for LIHEAP or any of the other social programs. Because I just think if you're working 40 hours a week, you should be nowhere near the poverty line.
No, you're absolutely right. And just to emphasize those polling results, Rick, we're talking really now about, you know, results coming in over more than a decade. And it's not just, you know, Democratic voters and independent voters who are in favor of raising minimum wage. Majority of Republican voters, you know, a group of folks who at times, you know, think, you know, it was a great thing that we invaded Iraq. A majority of those voters tend to view an increase in the minimum wage as a positive thing. And I think precisely for the reasons you laid out, they recognize that, you know, we want to value work in this society. And people who do make that choice to work should be paid and should be earn a living that enables them to you know, escape at a bare minimum level of the system.
You know, you look at the people who are against the minimum wage, and they always minimize it by saying, well, those minimum wage workers, they're just a bunch of pimply-faced teenagers getting their first job. And I got to tell you, the last time I went into a McDonald's or any of the fast food restaurants, I didn't see any pimply-faced teenagers. I actually saw people in my age group and older who were supporting pimply-faced teenagers.
Absolutely. You go to major retailers, Walmart, Target, all across the Commonwealth, it's not teenagers who are working in these low-wage employers exclusively. In fact, when we look at, we have some numbers from the folks at the Economic Policy Institute, and what they do is estimate, you know, take a look at data that we have on what people make per hour in Pennsylvania. And based on that data, they suggest that roughly 1 million workers would benefit from an increase in the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. And of that million, 81% are 20-year-olds. So we're really talking about an adult population. And, you know, the folks on the other side of this argument tend to be business lobbyists. Gene Barr stands out as one. one of the more prominent ones. You know, we faced Gene last time we tried to raise and successfully raise the minimum wage here in Pennsylvania. And Gene is back at his old tricks. He was writing in the Philadelphia Inquirer earlier this week, claiming that most of the people who earn minimum wage, come from wealthy families. The reality from the data is this, that of parents who are affected, would be affected by a minimum wage increase to $10.10 an hour, on average, those parents affected earn just over half of their family's income. So we're not talking about folks who, are physicians with a spouse who works part-time at a local library. We are really talking about people who are bringing home a substantial portion of their family's income. And certainly you can imagine, if we're talking about single heads of household, obviously that figure rises well above 51%. But we are talking really about people who are in a position of, just barely scraping paycheck to paycheck and often working in very unfavorable conditions and doing good work and benefiting us all.
No.
And I think it would be an important thing to sort of give them a boost and really break this cycle, Rick. And you talk about it, I'm sure, every night, right? We are stuck in a cycle of falling wages. I mean, we saw today there was a story in the New York Times, a hopeful story. Economists see the economy as a glass half full proposition.
Wow, nice.
Right. Well, that's great enthusiasm for the economics profession. All of the economists quoted were bank economists, folks who make their money working in the banking sector. And one of the key findings of that story where the bank economists reported, with unemployment so high, the reality is that wages are going to continue to fall, and that's going to be good for profit. So, life is good. The economy, the future is good.
For them.
For them, exactly. So I think, breaking that cycle means you got to fight back. And there are a lot of ways to fight back. One of them is to raise minimum wage. Another way, as you know, get a union.
Absolutely.
We need to get on the offensive, Rick. And I feel like we are. Maybe, it's the afterglow of the holidays, but I really feel like the progressive movement is doing a good job going after these folks who are really coming after middle class, working families, trying to harm them. And that, makes me feel good, even at 10 o'clock at night on a Friday.
And maybe taking on venomous flacks like Gene Barr, because I got to ask you, he's, for those who don't know, Gene Barr's the head guy over at the Chamber of Commerce in Pennsylvania, right?
That's right.
And I guess what popped into my head when you said that minimum wage workers come from wealthy families, his wealthy family, are there any minimum wage workers in his wealthy family? Because when my producer Brett looked up online how much he makes about $260,000 a year. Let me say that again, $260,000 each and every year. And this is a guy saying that $7.25 an hour is too much for an hour of work?
Stunning.
Breathtakingly stunning.
Yes, absolutely.
It just blows my mind. But, one of these things I've been asking, and maybe you can help me work through some of this, one of the questions I've been asking lately is, okay, if we're going to have this low-wage economy where we're going to continue to prop up the McDonald's and the Walmarts with all of the social spending for health care and food stamps and heating assistance and all of the other programs, don't we have to have this adult conversation of saying, okay, if we're hell-bent on a low-wage economy, can we please stop demonizing people who need a helping hand? Because after all, they are working.
Absolutely. And these low-wage employers understand it themselves. They are often the first to offer guidance and assistance to their staff. You're having trouble with housing? Here's the government program that will help you. You're having trouble with health care? Here's the government program that will help you. They have no problem encouraging their staff to take advantage of those resources, as they should. But the reality is those employers should be paying higher wages. Get them there. Really have to push on them, like I said, raise the minimum wage, more unions, getting aggressive with these employers and really rebalancing the situation in this country where, somebody who works for a living can expect a decent living.
No, but you're talking about redistribution of wealth.
That's a very good point. I think really what I'm talking about is wages should grow for everybody, not just those folks at the top.
I'm with
you. And the best way to do that, Rick, there are reasons you might want to argue for higher marginal income tax rates at the very high end. But the reality is we're only going to tackle this inequality problem if we really return bargaining power to folks in the middle and at the bottom of the wage distribution. Those are the folks who who are going to break the back of inequality, they've got to see their wages rise, and they've got to see them rise rapidly year after year. And really the only way to do that, you know, well, there are two ways. You can get unemployment down very low, or you organize workers, you get them to fight back and push on employers and drive up wages. Hopefully we'll get a combination of those forces, although the reality is that the economy is going to remain quite weak for a long time. But we are seeing a lot of activism, at least among workers, and that's hopeful.
Let me ask you, you know, because if you're going to have wages go up, there are a lot of people who say, well, if you let wages go up, then we'll have inflation, and that's bad.
It's certainly true that when individual wages go up, some employers may actually increase their prices. But there's no evidence to suggest, looking at the economy, looking at previous increases in minimum wage, or looking at other countries that have higher minimum wage, that they've experienced an increase in prices. Inflation is really a feature of the money supply and the domain of the Federal Reserve of the United States, not a factor that would be influenced by an increase in minimum wage, which tends to affect a relatively small portion of the labor market. So it's true you will see some increase in prices. You and I may end up having to pay a few more cents an hour for a burger or fries. But again, it in the overall scheme of things, it's not going to lead to a broad increase in prices. It will actually lift people's wages, and that's an important thing to do.
Last question I've got for you. You know, there's part of me that goes, they don't really care about the person making minimum wage. They're afraid that people in the middle, people who are making $10, $15, $18 an hour, that they're going to have to raise their wages as well. Because, look, I mean, that whole rising tide lifts all boats mentality. If you're making $15 or $16 bucks an hour, they don't want to pay $17 or $18. And I think that's one of the biggest drivers, in my view, and maybe you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, again, of why they fight so vehemently against it.
No, I think that's absolutely right. One of the reasons why we push for a minimum wage increase is precisely because it's not going to help those folks in the middle, but it pushes in the right direction and it gets people to, you know, perk up their ears and pay attention. When you think about, you know, a low wage employer like a fast food restaurant, it's not uncommon, for when you see a minimum wage increase in other states for those employers to suddenly find themselves having to raise the wages of their managing employees, right? The managers, the sort of that gold standard. We all want to become managers and, you know, have that really big house. Well, often managers in these operations don't earn very much either. So certainly there will be some positive spillover. It won't extend all the way up the wage distribution to folks in the middle earning $15 an hour in Pennsylvania. But when those folks look and see the minimum wage going up, gives them some confidence. It may inspire a little bit of militancy, which is good because it's going to end up putting employers back on their heel. And that's important because workers for the last 5 years have been back on their heel. They've been in a position where they're afraid to quit their jobs because unemployment's very high. They've been in a position where employers can ask them to work extra hours, can ask them to work overtime, ask them maybe in some cases to break labor law, work extra hours off the clock. And you do it because you're worried you need this job. Employers really have a lot of bargaining power now. Yeah. And I think a minimum wage increase, you're absolutely right. It has the potential of in the same way those minimum wage strikes over the summer and late winter did, it sort of gets people to pay attention. It gets them to think about their own employment situation and ask, hey, how can I make things better? Yeah. Maybe we can work together and ask for more.
I think it's very generous of you to say the employers ask them to work more hours and ask them to work overtime and ask them to break the law. I find it nice that you were so generous that they asked instead of how it really is. You will do it or you're fired.
You always have a choice.
I guess there it is. Mark, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time. Thanks for the information.
Hey, thank you, Rick. Good to be here.
Our good friend Mark Price, labor economist over at the Keystone Research Center. KeystoneResearch.org, the website. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the polecat dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. Fox News can't seem to talk about the Chris Christie bridge closure scandal without invoking Benghazi. Fox and Friends devoted 5 segments to the story Friday morning and somehow managed to bring up the September 2012 Benghazi attacks in each segment. But it wasn't just Fox. Here's Rush Limbaugh on Thursday.
We're spending now an hour press conference on lane closures on the George Washington Bridge. We haven't spent this much time in a press conference on four Americans dying in Benghazi.
And Laura Ingraham.
Why would we even comment about this Chris Christie issue? To even go on and on about this story, raising other issues, when we have four Americans dead in Benghazi, after the administration said, well, basically, what does it matter?
Media Matters has crafted a how-to checklist for conservative media covering the scandal. To check it out, please visit MediaMatters.org.
For generations, picture takers have instructed their subjects to say cheese. Well, no people say cheese better than Wisconsinites, who unabashedly wear cheesehead hats in public, celebrate dozens of cheese festivals, have a Monterey Jack bacterium as the state's official microbe, and generally honor the milk curd as a deity. So naturally, Wisconsin would be the state to come up with the idea of spraying its city streets with cheese brine. This is not some sort of cheesy tourist promotion, but an actual attempt to have two problems blend into one clever solution. Problem number one is ice. Wisconsin gets lots of it, with Milwaukee alone averaging more than 4 feet of snow each winter and spending some $10 million a year to apply rock salt to clear its frozen streets. Not only is that a lot of money, but about 30% of the dry salt bounces off the roadways and pollutes waterways. Problem number two is cheese brine. It's a waste product from cheese making, and this state produces nearly 3 billion pounds of cheese a year, so it has lots of brine. It costs a typical dairy farmer thousands of dollars each year to dispose of it. But this winter, farmers are donating their waste problem to cities like Milwaukee, which are hauling the brine to their road maintenance facilities and blending it into the rock salt. The idea is to create a mixture with just the right stickiness to keep the salt from bouncing away. You want to use provolone or mozzarella, says a Milwaukee Public Works manager. Those have the best salt content. You have to do practically nothing to it. This is Jim Hightower saying, voila, two messes equal a neat solution. Wisconsin officials still consider their cheese-coated streets an experiment, but it seems to be working out just fine. And it's just one example of a myriad of innovative alternatives being produced by local governments all across our country. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Minimum wage!
Means when they pay you minimum wage, you know what they're trying to tell you is like, hey, if I could pay you less, I would.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. So the polling out by Quinnipiac on the minimum wage, they looked at the 50 years after the war on poverty, and they asked some questions about minimum wage. And they found that 71% of the people that they polled supported raising the minimum wage, only 27% against. And not surprisingly, look, 52% of Republicans said, yeah, we should raise the minimum wage, as opposed to only 45% who said, no, we shouldn't. 33% said it should be lifted to $10.10 an hour. 18% wanted a little bit lower. 18% wanted higher. But overall, you're talking about a strong majority of the American people saying, absolutely, we should be raising the minimum wage. We value work in this country, and we should reward it, right? At least that's where I stand. And I look at this guy in... The gubernatorial races are interesting for fun, kind of a funny season, if you will. You got these guys who are trying to rile up their bases. So in Illinois, there's a Republican running for governor, a guy named Bruce Rauner. Bruce is a very wealthy private equity guy. In fact, he's so wealthy that during his private equity career, he has made an average of $7.36 per second. Now, understand, the minimum wage in the country is $7.25. He makes that every second. Think about that for every second of every day. Think about that. It's amazing. While he was doing a radio interview this week, he said that Illinois, who's right now their minimum wage is $8.25 an hour, a dollar ahead of the federal minimum wage. Now, by the end of the year, they've passed a law that's going to raise it to $10 an hour by the end of this year. He's saying we should go back to the federal minimum wage. Take that dollar an hour away from those low-wage workers and don't give them the increase because that's what's good for business. This is a guy made more than the minimum wage every second. I mean, it's... I find it really interesting that you get these extraordinarily wealthy people. People like Rahner, people like Gina Reinhart, the billionaire heiress in Australia, where the minimum wage, I think, is like $17 an hour, who said, well, you should be like Africa. Make them work for $2 a day. Make them desperate. Because her father had a mining empire in Africa. And that's how she, the hardest day's work this woman probably ever did was making it through the birth canal. But she's going to say that people should only make $2 a day. I mean, that's just mind-blowing to me. And the very people who are saying that we need to be cutting this stuff are the very people we should have nowhere near government. These are the people who go, here, Walmart, have billions of dollars. Here, fast food industry, have billions of dollars. You know, each and every year, in this country, we give Walmart $1.2 billion, the largest employer in the country, the most profitable, one of the most profitable, one of the largest corporations in the world. We give them $1.2 billion each and every year in tax breaks and free land and you name it, we give it. Here, take it. Thanks for creating those minimal wage jobs. Same thing with the fast food industry. We give the fast food industry billions of dollars. In fact, McDonald's, we give them $1.2 billion. Must be something with that number. Here, have $1.2 billion. Go do something. The fast food industry, the seven publicly traded corporations, collectively they had a profit of $7.4 billion last year. $7.4 billion these seven companies put in their pocket. They paid their average compensation to their CEOs and to their executives almost $53 million a year. And then they spread the money a little around a little bit. They bought some of their stocks back. They paid dividends, about $7.7 billion. And they're saying, sorry, we can't pay our workers a little bit more. Are you kidding me? And what gets me fired up is that because we hear the Republicans talk a lot about this idea of a meritocracy, this idea if you do more work, you should make more money. And we used to think that way pre-Reagan. We used to think that way until the uncoupling of productivity and wage growth. But had wages kept pace with productivity, had the minimum wage stayed with productivity, the minimum wage would be $21.72 an hour because productivity has gone up that high. And had the minimum wage kept up with the wage growth of our elite, our top 1%, well, it'd have been $22.62 an hour. Far above the $7.25, far above the $8.25 that they're making in Illinois, far above the $10.10 that legislators here in Pennsylvania say we should be paying 2 years from now. I'm telling you, it's maddening to hear these extraordinarily wealthy people who have never had to look their kids in the eyes and say, you know what, I'm sorry, there's nothing in the cupboards, and I don't have any money to put anything there. Sorry, the lights are going to be turned out, or the heat's going to be turned off, or we're being evicted from our home, or being kicked out of, foreclosed on our home and being evicted. And all we hear from people is, well, you know, those pimply-faced teenagers. When we know that's not reality. And then the other canard that we hear, oh, it's just going to hurt the small businesses. I got to be honest with you. I don't think I know any small businesses that pay minimum wage. I think most of them pay a little bit above because they have direct contact with the person who works for them. And they don't want to see them starving. They don't want to see them out in the street. Which is why it's not surprising that two-thirds of low-wage workers, two-thirds, I mean, this is a huge number, two-thirds of low-wage workers work for companies with 100 or more employees. This idea that mom and pop's paying minimum wage is, well, not supported by fact. What is supported by fact is we're giving these big corporations tons and tons of our tax dollars. And it's not reverberating through our economy. It's not getting into the hands of the workers who can then go and spend it and get this economy moving. And then we turn around. We have the unmitigated gall, the audacity to point our finger at these people and say, well, you need food stamps. How dare you? And we've got a governor who says, you know what, we're not going to expand Medicaid to cover the low-wage working poor. How dare he? But it's easy to point the finger, isn't it? Especially when the folks who you're pointing at are voiceless, are powerless, and are helpless to fight back. I'm telling you, the more people fall below that line, the more I think you're going to see more people rising up. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, and talk a little bit about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. You're not going to want to miss this. Right back.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
According to a new poll from Quinnipiac University, Americans support raising the minimum wage by 71 to 27%. The poll also finds Americans support extending unemployment benefits by 58 to 37%. 51% of people polled think the minimum wage should be raised to $10.10 an hour or higher. Consideration is underway in the U.S. Senate right now to extend jobless benefits by 3 months. A new Americans United for Change national ad features some workers who are losing their unemployment benefits.
I lost my job probably about 6-7 months ago.
I'm a year short of being qualifying for my retirement.
They had some cutbacks. I was the most skilled technician and also the highest paid. My retirement is going away as a result of this.
I do have a husband. Thank God. Or I would be homeless.
Tell Republicans, restore unemployment benefits now.
I was completely blown away by how many signatures we've gotten.
A Change.org petition launched by an anonymous Staples worker has gathered more than 166,000 signatures calling on Staples to stop dodging legal requirements of the Affordable Care Act by cutting part-time hours of its workers. A worker using the pseudonym Sue Whistleblower worked for years between 30 and 35 hours a week at Staples, but starting last month, Sue and other Staples workers had their hours cut back to just 25 hours a week with no exceptions. Sue believes that Staples did it to avoid having to provide health insurance coverage to the workers under the Affordable Care Act.
I just want to thank the folks that have signed our petition at change.org. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You know, this is definitely sending a clear message that Staples and other companies like this cannot abuse their workers and abuse loopholes just because they can and just to save money. And hopefully we will send a clear message. If they abuse their employees, people will take their money elsewhere.
Sue says the Affordable Care Act is working despite efforts by Staples and others to sabotage it.
As convoluted as the process was, it worked. And I'm hoping to get my new insurance cards here shortly.
Public employees in New York City are entering new contract talks feeling no longer demonized by the mayor. New Mayor Bill de Blasio is perceived as being much more worker-friendly than multi-billionaire Mike Bloomberg was. The unions in New York City say that a whole different tone is being set by the new mayor. The unions told New York City's Labor Press that the union-city relationship is going to be reset based on honesty, respect, and a shared commitment to making the city work. The 300,000 New York City public workers haven't had raises in years. The unions estimate city workers have lost a combined total of $6 to $7 billion. Nobody is expecting the contract talks to be easy, but the unions believe that the new de Blasio administration will be an effective and progressive one that respects workers.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I will oppose the Columbia Free Trade Agreement.
Now it's time to clear the way for a series of trade agreements.
You can trust me.
From the Monongahela Valley to the Mesabi Iron Range, the coal mines of Appalachia. Story's always the same. 700 tons in the middle of the day. Now, so you tell me the world's changed. One one son made you rich enough to forgive my name in Youngstown.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So yesterday, as we pointed out before the end of the show last night, House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dave Camp, the Republican, along with Republican Orrin Hatch and Democrat Max Baucus, Chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, or members of the Senate Finance Committee, put forth this fast track authority to begin the Trade Priorities Act of 2014, which I guess is going to get us towards the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or what I've been calling NAFTA on steroids. And here to help us work through some of this is Ben Beachy. He's the research director over at Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Ben, thanks for taking time for us.
Of course. Thanks for having me on.
So I look at this, and look, I think everybody was expecting it to come down. I think it was, I think everyone was expecting it. But, you know, yesterday it just seemed kind of convenient with all the Chris Christie stuff going on that it kind of flew under the radar.
Yeah, it certainly did fly under the radar for some folks. I think it will be, though, an increasing fight as the coming months pass. You know, the thing to know about Fast Track is that they wanted to introduce this thing, you know, actually as early as a year ago. It was because of such public opposition to it and opposition within Congress that they were not able to. Now they've introduced it in an election year, which gives them a very short window to try to get passed. Meanwhile, you have widespread opposition to Fast Track in Congress. Late last year, you had 151 Democrats. About 27 Republicans and a majority of Democrats in the Ways and Means Committee, which is the Trade Committee and the House, all say no to the old version of Fast Track, which this replicates. We've done a side-by-side analysis of the Camp-Baucus bill that was released yesterday and the 2002 Fast Track that Bush used to ram through a number of so-called trade deals. And some sections are actually just word for word the same. And overall, it replicates the same controversial fast-track mechanism that allows the president to unilaterally set the terms for a trade pact, negotiate the entire trade pact, and sign it before Congress gets to vote on it, thereby locking in the content. And then when Congress does get to vote on it, they only get 90 days to do so. There's no amendments allowed and very limited debate. And so it really is the same old power grab that we've seen in the past. It's a really not anti-democratic maneuver. It's the same sort of maneuver that we've seen since Richard Nixon cooked up Fast Track in the 70s.
Yeah, I was against it when H.W. Bush asked for it. I was against it when Clinton asked for it. I was certainly against it when W. was asking for it, and I'm against it now. I think, and I can't imagine being a member of Congress going, sure, we're going to abdicate our responsibility here, do our jobs for us. It makes very little sense to me.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You have an interesting coalition of people in Congress saying no to this because, you know, a number of Democrats are against the TPP because of its threats to access to medicines, what it would mean for offshoring jobs, it's the threats to food safety would pose, financial deregulation, et cetera. But then you also just have people on both sides of the aisle who are just see this as undemocratic and believe that any agreement that implicates such a wide swath of critical policies that are under Congress's jurisdiction needs to have full involvement of Congress rather than a circumvention of Congress. And then you have some Republicans who are just straight constitutionalists and see this rightfully so as an abrogation of the Constitution's placing of exclusive authority over trade with Congress. And so you have you don't have bipartisan anything happening on the Hill these days, and yet you have a bipartisan coalition saying no to Fast Track.
Yeah, you know, but I look at this, and, you know, didn't we learn our lesson from NAFTA? Haven't we learned from the bad trade deals of the past? Because I don't know anybody who looks to NAFTA and says, yeah, let's emulate that. Let's do that again. That seemed like it really worked for the working people of this country, and not just here in the U.S., but for the people in Mexico as well.
Yeah, NAFTA just turned 20. And we just did a report that took stock of what two decades of NAFTA's legacy has really meant. It was sold on grand promises that, you know, there'd be a net creation of about 200,000 jobs in the United States per year. The reality is the opposite. There's been a net loss of about 1 million jobs, according to the best studies we find on the matter. In addition, that's not just lost jobs for that's not just a hardship for those who actually lost their jobs, but those lost jobs, many of them in manufacturing, have contributed to wage stagnation for much of the middle class and growing income inequality, as those workers had to take a pay cut as they started looking to non-offshoreable service sector jobs like hospitality and food service, thereby placing downward pressure on wages in those sectors. You know, it really it contributed greatly to the wage stagnation we've seen and the soaring income inequality we've seen since NAFTA has passed. In addition, for Mexico, it was no boon either. It was sold to Mexico as, you know, we're going to bring Mexico into the first world. Well, what happened was, though it was called free trade, the deal allowed the United States to still highly subsidize large-scale agribusinesses and export their product, namely corn, to Mexico. While Mexicans did not, Mexican farmers did not enjoy the same support. And that influx of highly subsidized cheap U.S. corn put about 1.1 million small-scale farmers out of business, and in addition to about 1.4 million agricultural workers. So over around 2.5 million farmers and workers are out of work. Many of them were told, well, that's okay, you can come work in factories that are going to appear along the border thanks to NAFTA. But those that promise of jobs in factories and the manufacturing sector also evaporated as China joined the World Trade Organization and its sweatshop products to the United States undercut were cheaper than the products being assembled in Mexico, and those factories soon disappeared. What does that mean if you lost your job in the field and then you've lost your job in the factory? Well, you had a huge number of people looking for work. That put downward pressure on wages in Mexico. And it also contributed to a doubling of immigration from Mexico to the United States in the years after NAFTA passed.
Yeah,
so we have seen the legacy of NAFTA, and are we really going to sign a NAFTA-expanding deal such as the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Yeah, it seems ridiculous to me. But, you know, one of the big problems I have with this, outside of that, it's supposedly, from what I've heard, just like NAFTA, but I don't know what's in it. In fact, when I talked with Alan Grayson, you know, back when we were at NetRich Nation, he said, I can't tell you what's in it. I've seen it, but I can't tell you. Because only 600 lobbyists or what were they called, trade advisors, were allowed to be participating in this. You, me, at least, did you get to see it? Because I guess I'm not allowed.
No, those trade advisors are by and large corporate. Some of the largest U.S. corporations are involved in represented in that group. They have privileged access to text, secret negotiating text. And members of Congress were even denied access to many draft negotiating texts up until this last summer, largely through the noise made and pressure made by people like Alan Grayson. What we know about it is largely just through leaks, because, you know, this is, you know, even the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, published online the full negotiating text of the Free Trade Area of the Americas while it was under negotiation, so that anyone could see it. Comparing that example with what the secrecy we've seen under the TPP now, we're just asking the Obama administration to uphold the same standard of transparency as demonstrated by the Bush administration.
And that's not a high bar, I don't think.
I would say not. But we have seen a few things from the leaks, and one of those things is the investment chapter, and that is an incredible expansion on the NAFTA Chapter 11, which empowers foreign corporations to directly challenge a sovereign government, to circumvent the domestic legal system and appeal to a three-person foreign tribunal to determine whether or not a given health or environmental policy that the corporation finds inconvenient is valid. And if the tribunal determines that, no, it's not valid and it violates rights granted by the deal itself, to foreign corporations, then that corporation has a right to be compensated for expected future profits, and the tribunal is authorized to order taxpayers to pay the corporation for the existence of health or environmental policies.
So give me an example of that. I mean, you know, so if let's say we decide we don't want children smoking, and we're not going to allow children to be advertised to for cigarettes, for instance, and a country says, well, we're going to advertise to our kids, could they then sue us for that?
So yeah, the smoking is actually a really relevant example right now. Philip Morris is going around the world using these kind of provisions that's called the investor state regime to challenge any country that that uses progressive anti-smoking policies such as plain packaging, you know, where they say smoking kills in big bold letters and show a picture of a tracheotomy on a cigarette box. Australia had such a policy. Uruguay had such a policy to try to counter smoking. Philip Morris tried to fight that policy tooth and nail in Australia's courts and lost. They went the whole way to the high court, which is the equivalent of our Supreme Court, and Philip Morris lost. Then Philip Morris used one of these investment treaties using the same terms that are found in NAFTA and the same terms that are being proposed for the TPP to say, well, we don't care what the domestic courts decided. We're now going to ask a three-person tribunal comprised of three private lawyers to determine whether or not Australia's plain packaging law violates our broadly written investor rights. And if so, Australia would have to pay Philip Morris for the existence of a policy that was upheld in its own courts. They're doing the same thing against Uruguay. And so this really provides a backdoor for corporations to try to roll back or at least get compensated for the policies that they do not like.
So this is basically just consolidating power into one entity, so they don't have to fight in individual countries. They can just say, we're going to go to this secret tribunal that you or me or anybody else doesn't seem to have much influence or knowledge of, because I guess we don't get to know who the three panelists are, the folks there. And I guess, how are they chosen?
Yeah, you can actually know who they are, but it doesn't make any difference. They're not accountable to any electorate. They're an international tribunal. They're chosen. One, the country that's defending itself gets to pick one. Usually, corporation gets to pick another, and a third has to be agreed on between the two of them. Increasingly, these tribunals have used increasingly expansive notions of the rights that foreign corporations have. Allowing, for example, a corporation to argue that, at the time we invested in your country, we expected that the regulatory framework would not really change. We expected to have, you know, financial regulations or environmental regulations more or less the same. But what happens if you have a financial crisis or a climate crisis and the government decides to enact a new batch of policies, such as, you know, Dodd-Frank? Tribunals have been increasingly saying one of the foreign corporations' rights is a right to see their expectations not frustrated. It's incredible. I mean, a government under those terms would lose the right to regulate, and yet this is such extraordinary provisions are included in the TPP as revealed by that leaked chapter.
That is just absolutely amazing. Just blows my mind. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Ben Beachy, he's research director of Republic Citizens Global Trade Watch. The president last year said that he had a goal of creating 1 million new jobs in manufacturing by 2017, and I just saw a report came out, and in 2013, only 77,000 new manufacturing jobs were created last year, so it's a long way to go to get to that million. And some would argue, and I've heard the argument, that this trade agreement would increase manufacturing jobs. Can we look to the past? Can we look to anything that would say, you know, this is what we've done in the past, and this is going to lead us to what the future has in store for us, and 1 million new manufacturing jobs? Anything?
I'm not sure where you would be getting the notion this would create have a net creation of manufacturing jobs. Japan, for example, there's been arguments that, you know, we should be able to export more cars to Japan, but right now Japan has quite a few barriers that they're not likely to get rid of on our exports of cars. Meanwhile, the TPP would phase out some tariffs on Japanese exports of automobiles to the United States. So there's certainly quite a bit to be lost, or that we would stand to lose in terms of manufacturing jobs as well. And if we just look at the history, I mean, under NAFTA, for example, again, most of that million jobs that were lost were actually in manufacturing. There's a specific program run by the U.S. government that's very narrow, very difficult to qualify for, and thus underestimates the job loss. And even they estimate that they have actually counted specific workers who have been displaced by NAFTA, and they came up with the number 845,000 since NAFTA was passed. And so how are we going to approve another NAFTA-style deal where NAFTA has contributed such massive manufacturing job loss and expect manufacturing job gain?
Yeah, I'm with you. Because to me, this deal to me is very simple. It comes down to almost a sentence. It's bad for working people. It's good for Wall Street. It doesn't seem to get, to me, any simpler than that.
Yeah, and the Wall Street piece is important. There's the rules that that have been proposed for this deal that would roll back much of the attempts to re-regulate Wall Street. For example, rules on firm size, on a bank's size, to try to keep banks from becoming too big to fail, contradict some of the provisions that have been proposed for the TPP. And so it really is, it's a backdoor means for Wall Street to be able to have some protections, have some rules to try to fight against Dodd-Frank in a way that they've not been able to do so in Congress.
You know, I just saw the trade numbers. The trade deficit numbers came out for November, and we have a trade deficit with the Chinese of about $293.9 billion as of November. That's not December's number. We're actually ahead of 2012's record-breaking number. Some argue, and I'm not one of them, and I'm curious of your thought, but some argue that to push the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement through would somehow, and I'm not quite sure how, magically lower our trade deficit with China. I'm curious of your thought.
I'm not sure how that would be. China's not a member of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, so I don't really see how. Yeah, I don't really see how that would affect our burgeoning trade deficit with China. But you know, again, if passed as precedent, under NAFTA, we went from about $2.5 billion surplus with Mexico in 1993 and a $29 billion deficit with Canada, into a combined exploded $181 billion deficit under NAFTA. So the Mexico surplus turned into a massive deficit, and the Canadian deficit grew dramatically. For those who are who are quite wary of U.S. trade deficits, these kind of pacts have not been kind to you in the past.
Yeah. So let me ask you a last question. How do we stop this? Do you think it's going to make it through this session? Where do you see this going, and how do we stop it?
Well, the way to stop it is to stop fast track, because the deal is so controversial, both outside of Congress and the public and within Congress, that the administration has been pretty blunt that we need fast track to get this thing done, to get the TPP through. They need to be able to bind Congress's hands, limit Congress's ability to actually shape the contents of the deal, limit debate, limit amendments. So if you are against the TPP, you really need to be out in front right now pushing against fast track. So one of the best things to do is to make sure your representative has taken a stand against fast track. As I mentioned, a wide swath of people in Congress have already said no to fast track, and if not, encourage them to do so. Simply on the basis of that they should not be abdicating their constitutional authority over trade, much less the deal that would be pushed through under fast track is a net loss, would be a net loss for the majority. One good place to go to find information on whether or not you're a member of Congress is on the right side or not of fast track is exposethetpp.org. That's exposethetpp.org. It gives you all kinds of information on what the TPP means for everything from Wall Street to food safety to the foreign corporations powers that I was mentioning. It also gives you a way to take action pretty easily to contact your member of Congress and ask them to say no to Fast Track.
And we'll make sure we get links at thericksmithshow.com. Ben, it was great talking with you. I appreciate the time. Hope you'll come back as this continues down the road. This is not done, but I hope you'll come back and talk to us again in the near future.
Certainly. Thanks for having us on.
Thanks so much, Ben Beachy, Research Director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
For generations, picture takers have instructed their subjects to say cheese. Well, no people say cheese better than Wisconsinites, who unabashedly wear cheesehead hats in public, celebrate dozens of cheese festivals, have a Monterey Jack bacterium as the state's official microbe, and generally honor the milk curd as a deity. So naturally, Wisconsin would be the state to come up with the idea of spraying its city streets with cheese brine. This is not some sort of cheesy tourist promotion, but an actual attempt to have two problems blend into one clever solution. Problem number one is ice. Wisconsin gets lots of it, with Milwaukee alone averaging more than 4 feet of snow each winter and spending some $10 million a year to apply rock salt to clear its frozen streets. Not only is that a lot of money, but about 30% of the dry salt bounces off the roadways and pollutes waterways. Problem number two is cheese brine. It's a waste product from cheese making, and this state produces nearly 3 billion pounds of cheese a year, so it has lots of brine. It costs a typical dairy farmer thousands of dollars each year to dispose of it. But this winter, farmers are donating their waste problem to cities like Milwaukee, which are hauling the brine to their road maintenance facilities and blending it into the rock salt. The idea is to create a mixture with just the right stickiness to keep the salt from bouncing away. You want to use provolone or mozzarella, says a Milwaukee Public Works manager. Those have the best salt content. You have to do practically nothing to it. This is Jim Hightower saying, voila, two messes equal a neat solution. Wisconsin officials still consider their cheese-coated streets an experiment, but it seems to be working out just fine. And it's just one example of a myriad of innovative alternatives being produced by local governments all across our country.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Everybody's gonna pay.
Yeah, the $1 million man. I mean, do you buy these free trade arguments? Do you have we not had enough of it? I mean, just really quick. I mean, at the end of this, what it's going to mean if this gets rammed through, it's going to mean lower wages, it's going to mean less jobs, it's going to mean more profit for Wall Street. It's that simple. It doesn't get any easier than that. And on the other side of it, it's going to mean less say by voters. It's going to be more consolidation of our regulatory bodies on the international stage. It's just mind-blowing, which is why we absolutely, positively, without question, have to stop it in its tracks. That simple. Going to take a quick break. Right back with Hour 3. If you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on the smartphone. Any thoughts, any questions, something on your mind, you can always email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back with Hour 3. Stick around.
Intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
According to a new poll from Quinnipiac University, Americans support raising the minimum wage by 71 to 27%. The poll also finds Americans support extending unemployment benefits by 58 to 37%. 51% of people polled think the minimum wage should be raised to $10.10 an hour or higher. Consideration is underway in the U.S. Senate right now to extend jobless benefits by 3 months. A new Americans United for Change national ad features some workers who are losing their unemployment benefits.
I lost my job probably about 6-7 months ago.
I'm a year short of being qualifying for my retirement.
They had some cutbacks. I was the most skilled technician and also the highest paid. My retirement is going away as a result of this.
I do have a husband. Thank God. Or I would be homeless.
Tell Republicans, restore unemployment benefits now.
I was completely blown away by how many signatures we've gotten.
A Change.org petition launched by an anonymous Staples worker has gathered more than 166,000 signatures calling on Staples to stop dodging legal requirements of the Affordable Care Act by cutting part-time hours of its workers. A worker using the pseudonym Sue Whistleblower worked for years between 30 and 35 hours a week at Staples, but starting last month, Sue and other Staples workers had their hours cut back to just 25 hours a week with no exceptions. Sue believes that Staples did it to avoid having to provide health insurance coverage to the workers under the Affordable Care Act.
I just want to thank the folks that have signed our petition at change.org. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You know, this is definitely sending a clear message that Staples and other companies like this cannot abuse their workers and abuse loopholes just because they can and just to save money. And hopefully we will send a clear message. If they abuse their employees, people will take their money elsewhere.
Sue says the Affordable Care Act is working, despite efforts by Staples and others to sabotage it.
As convoluted as the process was, it worked. And I'm hoping to get my new insurance cards here shortly.
Public employees in New York City are entering new contract talks, feeling no longer demonized by the mayor. New Mayor Bill de Blasio is perceived as being much more worker-friendly than multi-billionaire Mike Bloomberg was. The unions in New York City say that a whole different tone is being set by the new mayor. The unions told New York City's labor press that the union-city relationship is going to be reset based on honesty, respect, and a shared commitment to making the city work. The 300,000 New York City public workers haven't had raises in years. The unions estimate city workers have lost a combined total of $6 to $7 billion. Nobody is expecting the contract talks to be easy, but the unions believe that the new de Blasio administration will be an effective and progressive one that respects workers.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell are we fighting for?
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So, you know, we've been hearing a lot from the radical right and their media mouthpieces about how the war on poverty was lost. It's lost. It's over. It was a failure. It was just like chucking a bunch of money down a huge fiery pit. And, you know, I keep saying if the war on poverty has been lost, then the people who have waged the war on the war on poverty have won. And it's exactly the same people who are saying that the war on poverty was entirely lost. You know, I look in the mirror and I say, you know, for me, thank goodness for the New Deal. Thank goodness for the Great Society, because it took me out of poverty and gave me an opportunity that millions of people like me had because of programs like this. And it's the folks who are out there, the mouthpieces out there now, saying that it was a failure, are the people who were always against it from the beginning and didn't want to give you that hand up. But here to talk a little bit about the 50th anniversary of Johnson's War on Poverty speech, maybe a couple other things, is our good friend Isaiah Poole from Our Future. He's the editor over at the OurFuture.org site. Isaiah, thanks for taking time for us.
Very much appreciate it.
You know, I look at all of these pundits who keep saying, oh, it was like chucking money down a hole. It was a waste. It, in fact, what was the one? Stossel said, well, it made women throw men out of the house.
It's utterly ridiculous. The truth of the matter is that to the extent to which that we kept the Great Society framework in place that Johnson created, to the extent to which we succeeded in doing that, we have programs like the nutrition assistance. We have, of course, Medicare and Medicaid that came out of that era. And all of those programs have actually succeeded in keeping millions of people out of poverty. And that was especially important during this recession.
Yep.
People look at the fact that we have a poverty rate of around 15% of the country today. It would far worse had these programs not been in place. So they've really enabled millions of people in the face of the greatest economic collapse since the Great Recession to be able to feed themselves, to clothe themselves, and to live in dignity while we go about the business of repairing the economy.
You know, you brought up the nutrition programs, and I tell the story all the time as a kid growing up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, that during the summer times we would go to the local elementary school where they would have a hot meal, and it wasn't much. It was like a little tin of beans and wieners, or maybe a grilled cheese sandwich or something. But for most of the kids that I knew in my neighborhood, that was the only hot, nutritious meal they got all day long during the summertime, because you know we were poor. And I remember remembering that as a kid, and then the Reagan years, where Reagan said ketchup's a vegetable and destroyed all of those nutrition programs that my friends and I benefited from as a child.
Well, exactly, and I had the same experience that you did growing up here in Washington, in low-income neighborhoods here in Washington, D.C. And I have to tell you that, because of the constraints that we've put on a lot of these programs, the effects are that for example, if you look at the areas of the country where there are high obesity rates and high diabetes rates, those are particularly the areas where we have high rates of poverty and where Republicans have been recently engaged in cutting support programs for people so that they could get adequate meals. It makes no sense, because a lot of these cuts in the Great Society programs have really been more expensive. We've actually lost more money than we've,
So by putting obstacles in the way, what you're saying is by putting obstacles in the way, we've made them more expensive, more difficult. And what I found interesting is a lot of the middle class folks who never thought they were ever going to need food stamps or unemployment or any of the things that thankfully they were there, or depression would have hit in 2008. A lot of the people I knew who had to then go apply for these things could not believe how difficult it was to navigate the system because of all these obstacles.
Precisely right. And, one of the great hypocrisies of the conservative movement is that we've made it extraordinarily difficult, and they're working to make it even more difficult to access basic benefits. The notion that so much is lost to fraud and abuse and so on. I was reading an article in the New York Times yesterday. There's a big fight over the farm bill right now. And the big fight over the farm bill at this moment, one of the fights, is over denying subsidies to people who actually don't engage in farming but get subsidies anyway. And when there was a suggestion made that we ought to actually have some things in place to make sure that people who receive farm subsidies are actually engaged in the business of farming.
Right.
The response from some of the conservatives on the Agriculture Committee was that was going to be too bureaucratically burdensome.
Because some of them own land that they get subsidies from.
Well, exactly. And they're not growing food. I can't buy vegetables from some of these Republicans who run these farms.
I think
farms,
Spencer Baucus is one of them, right? The guy from Alabama?
Exactly. But going back to your core point about where we are on the war on poverty, the war on poverty was not a 50-year fight. The war on poverty was, at best, a full-throated fight for about 3 or 4 years.
Right.
You know, almost from the time Johnson launched these programs, we went right into Vietnam, and that sucked a lot of resources out. It's the reason why Martin Luther King Jr., before he died, was ramping up a poor people's campaign, because so many resources were being sucked out of the sucked out for the Vietnam War, and too little was being devoted to the war on poverty. So we had this poor people's campaign that was in the process of being launched just as Reverend King was assassinated. We had Nixon come in, and Nixon rolled up back a lot of this. Reagan came in, rolled back even more.
Right.
Clinton came in and gave us welfare reform, which succeeded in cutting people from welfare rolls, but did not totally succeed in reducing dramatically the need. What we thought was a success in welfare reform was covered by the fact that there was a period of extraordinary growth in the economy. The minute that that growth disappeared, when President George W. Bush came into office in 2001, the benefits, quote unquote, of welfare reform began to disappear. And so here we are today with more need than we've ever had, and fewer resources available to meet that need.
Well, let me ask you this, Isaiah, because in going back and reading some of the poverty numbers and some of the information prior to the war on poverty and Johnson's Great Society, you saw senior citizen poverty rates in the 60-70% range. You saw senior women in the 90% range in poverty. Now you see it's 9%, 10%, a huge victory. Do you think it's that we don't know, we don't remember, that there aren't many people who remember what high rates of poverty there were and what it looked like in society, so that now we're so used to pointing our finger at those behind us? We've been fed this red meat of the Reagan years, the welfare queen driving around in the Cadillac, that we've lost touch on what actually was accomplished?
Well, we've lost touch of two things. We've lost touch of where we came from. That is true. We've also lost touch of the fact that everybody benefits when seniors or people who are looking for work or young children, we all benefit when they are able to live in dignity. There is no profit to society to have lots of starving kids who go to school and can't focus, can't do their schoolwork because they're hungry. There's no profit in having a person, you know, particularly a person in their 50s or 60s, who was thrown out of a middle management job during the recession and can't find a job after 26 weeks, to be told, okay, we're going to cut off all your money, you're going to lose your house, you're going to lose you're going to go bankrupt, and you're going to be out in the street.
Well, isn't that an incentive?
Why is the profit of society?
Isn't that the incentive? I mean, if you listen to the right wing in this country, that's an incentive for you to go out and get a job. Because obviously the last 26 weeks, you've been just on vacation.
I've had the experience of being unemployed. And let me tell you something. It is not, I want to slap the people who say this. I really do. Because they've never had the experience of sending out hundreds of resumes. And if you talk to any of the people who are on long-term unemployment insurance,
I've been there.
You know, they're going to the meetings. They're doing the networking. They're sending out the resumes. And I tell you, it is extraordinarily hard, particularly when you have a situation where many of these large corporations, they have their resume processes have automated. They sort. They have computers that sort resumes by algorithms and things like that. So you don't even get a chance to get in front of a human being to make a pitch, to sell yourself. And we have an economy that fundamentally on average, there's about 3 job seekers for every job. In many cases, Bloomberg was reporting this morning that when one of the airlines opened up a few hundred jobs for flight attendants, that would make $15,000 or $16,000 a year, maybe $20,000. They got like 10,000 applications.
Yeah, I mean, you see, like when I remember when Walmart, one of the Walmarts opened up in Cleveland, there were 300. I think they were mostly part-time jobs. They had like 3,000 or 4,000 people who lined up to get those part-time jobs because there's just nothing else. So the question then becomes, because I think we know that I hope everyone knows that there are more people out there looking than there are jobs available. So then the question becomes, shouldn't government step in and say we're going to be the employer of last resort? We're going to make sure that there's demand in the economy so that people get jobs?
Absolutely. And our co-director, Robert Borisaj, in fact, posted a column on our blog today making exactly that point. When you have a situation, as we did Friday with the announcement that the economy only produced about 67,000 jobs during the month, whether or not that's an anomaly, the truth of the matter is that's a loud call to say, Congress, you need to do a jobs program. There is a huge amount of money sloshing around on Wall Street. There's a huge amount of money sloshing around the corporate sector. A lot of the money is parked overseas, but none of that is coming down to Main Street. None of that's being invested in there because people don't have money. So the government has to step in and say, look, we will – there is a lot of work to be done to build our work on our transportation system, to get our schools shored up, to the fundamental foundation for economic growth, in other words. There's a lot of work to be done there. We can use government resources to get that going and put money in people's pockets. And that will incentivize the private sector.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. But instead of doing that, Isaiah, what just happened yesterday, which just has me doing backflips, is you've got Max Backdoras and Dave Camp and Orrin Hatch coming out with this, let's give fast-track authority to the president to pass the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement that we know will be just like NAFTA, we know will cost us more jobs and make unemployment worse, but yet that's their plan forward, which seems to me to be idiotic at best and criminal at worst.
Absolutely. And so it is incumbent upon everybody who's listening to this program right now to write their member of Congress, call their member of Congress, and say, no, we do not support fast-track trade authority. There is going to be all kinds of arguments about how this is going to open up opportunities, open up markets overseas, et cetera, et cetera. You just look at the NAFTA example. And we saw that when NAFTA and some of these other trade agreements have been signed, they have all worked to the disadvantage of the United States. And the reason they've worked to the disadvantage of the United States is because workers have not been at the table, only the corporations. They work for corporations, but they don't work for the rest of us.
No, I mean, the reason workers aren't at the table is because they're on the menu. I mean, the reality is we're getting eaten alive by these big corporate these global corporations who only care about the bottom line. And one of the things I've been saying here on the program for years, Isaiah, is if these companies who are sitting on trillions of dollars aren't going to invest here in this country, then we've got to have policy, we've got to have a tax code, we've got to have something that says if you're not going to do it voluntarily, we're going to take our money back. Those tax breaks we gave you, those huge loopholes we gave you, because you said you'd create jobs, you didn't, we're taking it back and we're going to do it for ourselves.
Well, that's precisely right. I mean, this is how, if ordinary people, when they try to get a government benefit, have to go through all kinds of hoops in order to get that benefit and have to be accountable for how they use that benefit, even more so should the corporations be.
I'm with you. You know, I saw this thing. I've been talking about the last couple of days. The governor of Maine, Paul LePage, spent some government resource to do a huge study on those welfare people who have the EBT cards. And they found 3,000 people use their EBT card at a bar or a sports bar or even a strip club. Out of 1.8 million transactions, they found 3,000, or as the Bangor Daily News put it, 0.2%, 0.2 tenths of 1%. Were used in this way, and they didn't know if the people who used them at the bars or the strip club were actually working there, but they just knew that this is bad. We're gonna make light of it. And I wish that we could take a look at all of the money that we give to General Electric and all of these huge multinational corporations. I wish we could look at how they use our money to do what they do.
Exactly right. We go back to when the Bush administration allowed the repatriation of overseas profits. And the promise back then was that if you allow money to come back into the United States that have been parked overseas, then we give you a special tax break with that money. The promise was that that money would be invested in the economy and create jobs. As you know, that money was actually used to buy back, to do stock buybacks.
Yep.
It was used to
put in their pocket.
Basically put it in their pocket. There was actually a net decline in the number of jobs in many of these countries. In other words, many of the countries that brought this money back, companies, actually laid off people while they were doing that. But we never went back to those companies and said, well, since you laid off people while you were getting this tax break, we are now going to cancel that tax break, and you owe the IRS.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Never said that.
There should be clawback in all of this stuff. The same thing when states give money to these companies to put pit neighbor states against one another. The same thing. If you're not creating the jobs, we want our money back. That simple.
Right.
So last question I've got for you, in moving forward, I mean, there are so many things to get worked up about, but I look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, got to be calling our legislator to stop that. But the unemployment thing to me is huge because, to me, it's a massive slap in the face to people who are struggling. And I guess, our friends on the right don't mind kicking people when they're down, but I do.
Oh, and so do we. And one of the things we've been saying is that unemployment benefits, the big argument right now is that unemployment benefits need to be paid for somehow. And specifically when you hear the argument that unemployment benefits should be paid for, it means that some other struggling person, some other struggling sector of the economy needs to be cut in order to support the long-term unemployed. And that should not be. Emergency unemployment, extended unemployment benefits have never been paid for in the past. They exist specifically because we have a crisis situation with unemployment in this country, particularly those who have been unemployed for longer than 27 weeks. And therefore, we shouldn't start now talking about paying for the 25 billion dollars or so it would take to extend this for another year, or the 6.8 billion it would take to extend it another 3 months. That should just be money that we are willing to spend because we are in a crisis right now.
Yep.
And we can get that money back once we resolve the crisis.
Yeah, I'm with you, and it's something we should be pushing wholeheartedly. We should be calling our representatives and pushing hard. Isaiah, it's always great to talk with you. I look forward to talking to you again in the near future as we continue our segments on Our Future Friday. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
That was great talking. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
For generations, picture takers have instructed their subjects to say cheese.
Well, no, people say cheese better than Wisconsinites, who unabashedly wear cheesehead hats in public, celebrate dozens of cheese festivals, have a Monterey Jack bacterium as the state's official microbe, and generally honor the milk curd as a deity. So naturally, Wisconsin would be the state to come up with the idea of spraying its city streets with cheese brine. This is not some sort of cheesy tourist promotion, but an actual attempt to have two problems blend into one clever solution. Problem number one is ice. Wisconsin gets lots of it, with Milwaukee alone averaging more than 4 feet of snow each winter and spending some $10 million a year to apply rock salt to clear its frozen streets. Not only is that a lot of money, but about 30% of the dry salt bounces off the roadways and pollutes waterways. Problem number two is cheese brine. It's a waste product from cheese making, and this state produces nearly 3 billion pounds of cheese a year, so it has lots of brine. It costs a typical dairy farmer thousands of dollars each year to dispose of it. But this winter, farmers are donating their waste problem to cities like Milwaukee, which are hauling the brine to their road maintenance facilities and blending it into the rock salt. The idea is to create a mixture with just the right stickiness to keep the salt from bouncing away. You want to use provolone or mozzarella, says a Milwaukee Public Works manager. Those have the best salt content. You have to do practically nothing to it. This is Jim Hightower saying, voila, two messes equal a neat solution. Wisconsin officials still consider their cheese-coated streets an experiment, but it seems to be working out just fine. And it's just one example of a myriad of innovative alternatives being produced by local governments all across our country.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I gotta listen to man.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. I got an email from Ben. Ben writes, your interview the other night on the jobs situation in the country was completely accurate. He said, I lost my job that I worked for nine years. I lost it back in 2008. And since that time, I've been unable to secure regular full-time employment. He says, I've bounced from temp job to temp job. Hoping each time that this would be the last. He says, I'm not alone in this, and thank you for reinforcing that message. There are thousands of us out here in the same boat who are unable to speak up out of fear that the crummy, poor-paying job that we have will be yanked away without a moment's notice. I just wanted to say thank you for talking about those of us who feel forgotten. You know, Ben, the reality is I don't know that most people realize the second largest employer in this country is a temporary agency. So a lot of these jobs that we are jumping for joy are coming back to our borders. All this manufacturing that's coming back, a good number of it is temp jobs. And look, this model has been growing for years because they want a disposable workforce. Understand, they don't want any, and this is really the whole business model that these business schools have been preaching. Have really, really super low costs, have very little liability, which is why you see everything being leased. And employees, you know, you have no costs associated with temp employees. If you don't need them, you go away. You're somebody else's problem. And then you have these temp agencies, especially the smaller ones, who have very little liability insurance and they go bankruptcy, at the drop of a hat. I'm of the mindset that there's got to be some regulatory, some legal changes done to change how things are going on now. And I saw the president stand with the guy who's the head of Amazon. And Amazon's one of those companies, and whatever you think of them, the mass of their employees are these third-party companies. And, you know, I've met a number of people over the last couple of months who they're in this situation where it's a constant desperation situation. And that's why I think employers want working people. the reason that there's such an assault on unions, and the reason that there's all of this nonsensical, ridiculous, venomous legislation out there, like the 1507, the Cutler bill, the Republican Cutler bill, that would say that, you know what, the state workers in the state, they can't negotiate if the state will have a checkoff. You know, like they do for anything, for the like they have for their bank accounts, or they have for United Way, or any charities, or any of that. You can't have that check off to pay your dues. Purely punitive, purely Machiavellian, if you will. The reason, because those are the last people in this country who really have an understanding that they have power. They want working people powerless. They want working people to feel defenseless and helpless and dependent. That, you know, if you lose your situation, you might not feel it, you get another one. So put up with the crummy conditions, put up with the poor wages, put up with the temporary status. I mean, think of how our economy has completely changed. You know, when my grandparents' generation roamed the earth, General Motors was the largest employer in the country. Manufacturing was front and center. Now you got Walmart and temporary agencies, one and two, Walmart and temp agencies. That doth not make a middle class. That doth not make a prosperous working class, especially at the poverty wages that are now being paid in these situations. And we need some serious change, and we need it really quickly. And we can talk about passing unemployment extension. We can talk about raising the minimum wage a little bit. But at the end of the day, if you're not seeing wages raised in warehousing and manufacturing and physical labor jobs where people have a very short lifespan, in doing these jobs, we got some serious problems. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
According to a new poll from Quinnipiac University, Americans support raising the minimum wage by 71 to 27%. The poll also finds Americans support extending unemployment benefits by 58 to 37%. 51% of people polled think the minimum wage should be raised to $10.10 an hour or higher. Consideration is underway in the U.S. Senate right now to extend jobless benefits by 3 months. A new Americans United for Change national ad features some workers who are losing their unemployment benefits.
I lost my job probably about 6-7 months ago.
I'm a year short of being qualifying for my retirement.
They had some cutbacks. I was the most skilled technician and also the highest paid. My retirement is going away as a result of this.
I do have a husband. Thank God. Or I would be homeless.
Tell Republicans, restore unemployment benefits now.
I was completely blown away by how many signatures we've gotten.
A Change.org petition launched by an anonymous Staples worker has gathered more than 166,000 signatures calling on Staples to stop dodging legal requirements of the Affordable Care Act by cutting part-time hours of its workers. A worker using the pseudonym Sue Whistleblower worked for years between 30 and 35 hours a week at Staples, but starting last month, Sue and other Staples workers had their hours cut back to just 25 hours a week with no exceptions. Sue believes that Staples did it to avoid having to provide health insurance coverage to the workers under the Affordable Care Act.
I just want to thank the folks that have signed our petition at change.org. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You know, this is definitely sending a clear message that Staples and other companies like this cannot abuse their workers and abuse loopholes just because they can and just to save money. And hopefully we will send a clear message. If they abuse their employees, people will take their money elsewhere.
Sue says the Affordable Care Act is working, despite efforts by Staples and others to sabotage it.
As convoluted as the process was, it worked. And I'm hoping to get my new insurance cards here shortly.
Public employees in New York City are entering new contract talks, feeling no longer demonized by the mayor.
New mayor Bill de Blasio is perceived as being much more worker-friendly than multi-billionaire Mike Bloomberg was. The unions in New York City say that a whole different tone is being set by the new mayor. The unions told New York City's labor press that the union-city relationship is going to be reset based on honesty, respect, and a shared commitment to making the city work. The 300,000 New York City public workers haven't had raises in years. The unions estimate city workers have lost a combined total of $6 to $7 billion. Nobody is expecting the contract talks to be easy, but the unions believe that the new de Blasio administration will be an effective and progressive one that respects workers.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
I didn't even know Alan Keyes was still around, but he's still writing, still stirring things up. He asked the question, can America afford to wait three more years for the chance to end Obama's destructive socialist coup d'etat? And I got to wonder if the guy even knows what the word socialist means or what it is. He goes on to write that the 2014 election may be our last opportunity to thwart and repeal the elitist factions push to overthrow our republic. And what's he talking about? Getting poor people health care. Yeah, that's it. We're going to take that health care back. Wow. Anyway, let's find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, long time no speak.
I know, it's crazy. So good to talk to you.
Did you have a good holiday?
I did have a good holiday. It was, well, you know, my idea of a good holiday these days is just sleeping because I get up at ridiculous hours. So I slept and I caught up on all the stuff that I taped.
There you go. Sleep is definitely not overrated.
No.
I like a good night's sleep as well. Have you been following this story in West Virginia where
yeah,
if you drink the water, you will have uncontrollable nonstop vomiting?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy, and it's kind of creepy because from what I can gather, and I'm finding it difficult to find this piece of the story because I keep trying to find out, how did they find out the stuff was in the water?
I would assume.
And there isn't a lot of information coming out yet about that.
Yeah. I've been calling it freedom water.
Freedom.
Nothing says freedom like nonstop vomiting.
Look, you are free when you vomit.
See? I love the names of the companies involved, though. Freedom Industries and American Water. You know, what could be better than glowing green toxic sludge water brought to you by American Water, thanks to our friends at Freedom Industries? I mean, that is a libertarian wet dream right there.
And then your extremities fall off.
And then your extremities fall off. And, you know, the thing is, I was just telling a friend of mine, what's probably going to end up happening is Freedom Industries changes their name to Patriot Industries, and we end up footing the bill.
Yeah.
You make it sound like, duh, don't we all know that?
Yeah. I mean, this is it. And of course, I was talking about space in West Virginia. You know, coal in West Virginia is known as King Coal.
Yep.
And it's how they do business, man. They're going to skate.
So now I got to wonder, all of the people who, because when we did our labor history tour over the summer, we went into Blair, West Virginia, the site of Blair Mountain, where we almost got shot, where the guys were walking around with their sidearms and all of that. I got to wonder, the people walking around with their Friends of Coal t-shirts and their Friends of Coal bumper stickers and their Friends of Coal machetes and bayonets and all that stuff, I got to wonder how they're feeling about being Friends of Coal now, in a situation of uncontrollable vomiting.
I don't think you're thinking about coal when you're vomiting.
Well, maybe they could do it in their Friends of Coal spittoon. Just a thought. Brought to you by Patriot Tobacco or something. Yeah, just amazing stuff. But you know, the thing that got me is all day yesterday, all we heard about was Chris Christie and the toll booths. And trust, believe me, I have been over the George Washington Bridge hundreds, if not thousands of times. It's always loaded with traffic. And to deliberately, in a punitive manner, shut down two lanes at rush hour all day long, I'm not a death penalty person, but I think in this case, I think it's warranted.
Oh, it absolutely is, in a very nasty bamboo kind of way.
No. What we do is we just drop them at a truck stop nearby.
And on the New Jersey side.
Right there. Let the truck drivers take care of them, the people who had to sit in that traffic for 6, 8, 10 hours to get through that cash box. Let them deal with it.
You get a couple of moms, too.
There you go. And, you know, the thing that got me, if you read the emails, and I'm sure you did, is the one person who said, oh, I feel for the kids, and the other person said, well, I don't. You know, they're so-and-so's voters.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's quite extraordinary. And then the emails are coming out today. It's quite extraordinary. There's internal emails about how they were bombarded with complaints. One email from an official at the Port Authority to the British General Manager said the woman called to discuss her hardship, saying, the Port Authority doesn't care about their customers and they're playing golf with people's jobs. And her husband was 40 minutes late to a job that he just got after being out of work for over a year.
Wow.
She said a lot of other things, but I will spare you her rent.
Now, they should have to go to her. Just 5 minutes in a room with her.
Yeah.
If you make it out, you can survive. Wow. But, you know, again, I don't put it past the petty partisan that we've seen, and I definitely don't put it past people who would be drawn to Christie, but I don't know, and maybe you've got a different idea, but I don't know if you're going to find Christie's fingerprints anywhere near this.
Oh, I don't think you are. I mean, you know, I'm going back to, you know, who will rid me of this meddlesome priest, you know, going back a good 1,000 years.
Yeah.
I don't know if he even said, I want him dealt with, or if he didn't say anything. I don't know if it was entirely their own harebrained scheme. And yet, this Bridget Ann Kelly doesn't sound like a harebrained person. I mean, she's been portrayed that way, but she's a 10-year, very experienced New Jersey political operative.
Yeah. And, you know, again, you go back to, and while I took the position yesterday, I don't think Christie ordered it or was part of it. I do believe it's the kind of people who are drawn to him. And that's where the blame, if anything could stick to him, that's just where my view is. Because I view the guy kind of as a bully. He's pushy. He's going to break some things. And those are the kind of people that are attracted to that. And I believe that that those are the folks who, you know, the petty retribution, the petty paybacks, this kind of stuff. And what gets me is if you're going to, because I think if Christie was going to do it, he'd want you to know he did it to you. These other folks, I'm not so sure.
That's a very interesting point. I haven't heard that point being made. Until you made that point about that he'd want you to know, and other people, the other ones might not want you to know about that. Makes me wonder whether he's going to change some of the people around him as he gets closer to 2016, whether he's going to be smarter after this.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because if I'm going to do something to you, Victoria, I want you to know I did it. Because there's no point. There's no political. There's no payback if you don't know it came from me.
No!
It's just causing you misery.
Exactly, especially in Jersey. I mean, you want them to know, don't you?
Exactly. The Sopranos and all that, there's got to be a call. There's got to be a horse head, right?
Yes!
Let's move on. Let's go to the unemployment bill. Is it going to pass? I know that it got over the first hurdle. I see Reid is going to take some amendments maybe. Tell me, what's going on?
Well, the word is that he is probably going to take some amendments from Republicans. Yesterday he wasn't going to consider any changes to the amended version of the bill, but today he will. It's an 11-month extension that they're talking about at the moment. So, yes, he's saying that he would consider some. The question is, what will he consider? Even if he'll consider them, are they going to be acceptable to Democrats? So, this is actually a big step for him, because yes, they would consider anything. But obviously they've all gone home now, so nothing's going to happen over the weekend except perhaps some talking and then some trashing on the Sunday shows. And then they've got to come back Monday and look like they're doing something, because meanwhile there's 1.3 million new people unemployed, and I think it's something like 70,000 people each week more going unemployed of the long term. I don't know if they're going to be able to get it done, because even if they get something through the Senate and they really disagree with each other in terms of what those amendments should be, you know, it faces a very uncertain fate in the House.
Which is interesting to me, though, is the, you know, the places, the states, the areas with the highest unemployment rates are the people who are their representatives are the most vehemently opposed to extending the unemployment that would help their own constituents. I mean, it's the same thing with the health care. The people who have the lowest rates of health insurance, they seem to have representatives who are dead set against the Affordable Care Act. It seems it just seems upside down to me, Victoria.
Well, it's government, isn't it? They don't want government involved.
Yeah, well, I guess that's it. But while they're pushing that, then people are dying. So job numbers out today, good, bad, and different. What do you think? 74,000. Does that keep up with the demographic growth?
No, it wasn't good. It was not good. Particularly since the estimate was 196,000 to 200,000.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, and I read about five articles this morning very early as I was working on my online newsletter, and they were all in that range. In fact, Mark Zandi was going even higher of Moody. And everybody was wrong. Everybody was wrong. In fact, Zandi is saying that he thinks this jobs report is an outlier. He thinks it's a fluke and anomaly, and he's pretty much disregarding it. A few others are, too. Some economists are saying that they think the wintry weather in many parts of the country may have skewed the data. But
well, it's January. I mean, really, it's January. You have the big build-up for Christmas, right? And then bang.
Right. Right. So it's really not clear why it was as weird as it was. So I think a lot of economists are saying, okay, we'll take our lump. We'll say this was a weird one, and we'll say it was a weird one. If the next one is bad as well, then we're going to get worried.
Right. And will we then start talking about, you know, some stimulus and maybe doing something? I don't know, building some roads or something, anything, you think? Any appetite for
that?
No. All right.
I don't think so. Well, the president's talking about infrastructure. Yes, he is talking about infrastructure.
Yeah, but he's been doing that for 5 years now. Nobody on the Republican side seems to be listening. But I guess... the way, if you hear it, with the NSA, evidently Obama's listening. Are they listening to Congress?
No.
No? Not listening to Bernie? Did you see the guy, I forget what his name is, one of these right-wing group guys who said that Bernie should be spied on, Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont, should be spied on?
I know. Well, he's so suspicious. Anybody who's an independent from Vermont, I mean, it's pretty suspicious in itself.
Yeah. It's the hair, I think.
Well, yes, it's pretty outrageous. It's too independent of itself.
It's got its own life. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I am.
And I also see that there was a three-day spending bill introduced in the House. Is this how we're going to be investing in the future of our country, 3 days at a time?
No. Well, actually, the talks on the budget, which will be a two-year budget, these are actually going quite well and in quite a grown-up manner, considering how many perils lie in this massive omnibus bill, how many riders, conservative riders, they could put on the EPA, all the abortions, all the thises and the thats, and the, you know, everybody's got something that they want. And they've managing to steer this thing through very carefully. It's nearly done. But they just can't quite get it done in time. So that's why they're going to probably have, very likely, I think now, a three-day continuing resolution just to get them past the finish line, and then they'll finish the thing after January the 15th. So they've just got to get us past the deadline for government shutdown, and then they'll finish it. But it looks like they're actually going to get it done, and we're actually going to have a genuine working budget for the first time in a few years.
Wow, say it isn't so. You know, because when I saw that, I've got a friend that I used to work with probably 20 years ago, and his thing was, every time you see him, how are you going? If I could just make it through the next 15 minutes. He lived his life 15 minutes at a time, and I often wonder what would happen if he couldn't get it. In 14 minutes, he just said, the heck with it, I wonder what would happen. But he was a guy, 15 minutes at a time. He never scheduled anything further than 15 minutes ahead.
Really?
Yeah. He was quite a character. But I often wondered if he didn't make it, what would happen? I'm glad. I just hoped I was never around.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but it's good that, you know, I'm glad to hear there may be some grown-ups in the room, and maybe the outrage of maybe Congress has gone, hey, you know, we're hated. We're literally hated, not just disliked, but literally hated. Maybe we should duck a little bit.
Well, that's why they're doing it. They're so nervous about having another government shutdown after the last one that that's one of the reasons why they're coming to get it done, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of reason to be angry. I mean, yesterday, I'm sure you saw this. The House passed a bill yesterday. They called it the Reducing Excessive Deadline Obligation Act. And basically what it did is it removed a number of the EPA requirements that would make people like Freedom Industries clean up their mess. I just thought it was just maybe coincidence, I don't know, but it just seemed very ironic that on the day you've got this massive spill, 300,000 people without water, if you drink it, you're going to vomit on command, and they're repealing the legislation that would make people clean that up.
It's just wonderful timing, and isn't it also interesting how that's not really being talked about very much today?
Yeah, we don't need no stinking regulations because nothing says freedom, Victoria, like uncontrollable convulsing vomiting.
Oh.
That's freedom.
It is freedom. There's a certain freedom in it, but it's not a freedom. When it's happening, it's not a freedom that you'd rather anything.
Yeah,
anything.
That's one of the freedoms I'm willing to give up.
I'll give it up.
Yeah. Not being in control of being... Now, if I go get drunk and I get falling down drunk and I vomit, yeah, that's, I should have the freedom to do that, yes. As long as I clean it up. Don't leave it for someone else. But if I didn't have anything to do with it and I accidentally drank the water that comes into my house, that's where I think I draw the line on it.
Oh, I think this is just terrible. I mean, to literally have no water in a city...
I like what the one woman said. I would really like to brush my teeth, please. Which, you know, and this is going to sound really mean, and I don't mean it to my West Virginia friends, but, you know, as the stereotypes go, there's not a lot of teeth in West Virginia. I thought it was odd that she said she really wanted to brush her teeth in West Virginia.
You know, you had to go there, didn't you?
You know me, I've got to say what hit my head. And maybe a brick will be what's next.
If you leave that room, it will, see.
All righty. Victoria, always great talk with you. Appreciate the time.
Thank you so much.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. Fox News can't seem to talk about the Chris Christie bridge closure scandal without invoking Benghazi. Fox and Friends devoted 5 segments to the story Friday morning and somehow managed to bring up the September 2012 Benghazi attacks in each segment. But it wasn't just Fox. Here's Rush Limbaugh on Thursday.
We're spending now an hour press conference on lane closures on the George Washington Bridge. We haven't spent this much time in a press conference on 4 Americans dying in Benghazi.
And Laura Ingraham.
Why would we even comment about this Chris Christie issue? To even go on and on about this story, raising other issues, when we have 4 Americans dead in Benghazi, after the administration said, well, basically, what does it matter?
Media Matters has crafted a how-to checklist for conservative media covering the scandal. To check it out, please visit MediaMatters.org. This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. Fox News can't...
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you out there. Oh, now the good old union has come in here to win. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Oh. That's the question. Which side? Which side are you on in all of this? The side of the big multinational corporations or we, the people? And, you know, I'm hung up on a number of things today, and it's one of those days where you see what's going on the state level. You see on the state level, you've got the Republicans who fear that they're going to lose power in November. So it's, better hurry up and get our wish list passed through. Better get our homage paid to the Wall Street tycoons. Better shore up that next job in the event that I get voted out, because we haven't done anything in the last couple of years, or at least anything that, that can be misconstrued as good. So if you work for a living in this state, you're about ready to get really shafted if these people get their way. Just like in Michigan when they rammed through the right to work for less nonsense there. They did it because another reason I'm against term limits, by the way, but they did it because the elected officials there had nothing to lose. They knew they were going out the door and they needed to secure their next job. They needed to protect their behind. Everybody else be damned. Understand, this year is when the redistricting goes into effect. All of those reps who are looking at their district going, maybe I'm not going to make it. Maybe I'm being gerrymandered out. There's some worry on my part here. And again, I go back to the whole term limit thing. There are people who say, we need term limits. The best term limit we already have. That's access to the ballot box. While we still can, while we're still able to cast our ballot, which one of the things that infuriates me is we have such one of the worst turnout rates of countries around the world, that you have so many people who take that right for granted, to take that absolute constitutional, God-given right for granted. And it's on. I go back to, what my high school government teacher said. And, you think back to times and moments in your life that someone, throws you a pearl of wisdom that sticks. For him, for me, it was pretty simple on the voting front. It was, he said, don't bother voting. Stay home. You 18-year-olds in this next election, Reagan was running for re-election. Stay home. Don't bother casting your vote. It's a waste of time. This way, he says, if you stay home, it'll make my vote that much stronger. And the right understands that, especially here in Pennsylvania, where the voter registration numbers are so heavily in favor of Democratic candidates. The Republicans understand the only way they win statewide elections is to, as Tom Corbett said when he was running for governor, hold down the vote in Philadelphia. And this voter suppression that they passed, that's what it was for. Think of the last couple of years on the state level. What have they done that has benefited the Commonwealth? Nothing. Everything could have been done better. Everything. And on the state level, man, this free trade agreement that they're talking about, haven't we had enough with the free trade agreements? Haven't we had enough of the offshoring, job-killing, wage-reducing trade agreements that we've had, and not to mention deficit exploding trade agreements? We're on pace this year to exceed our trade deficit again with China. Now, last year was a record high. This year will be another record high trade deficit. And as I've said before on the program, you look at our trade deficit, you look at our national debt, and you know what? Oddly enough, they mirror one another. Had we balanced trade, we would probably have closer to balanced budgets. So when people say we need to have a balanced budget amendment, how about having a balance of trade? How about having a balanced trade amendment? And that's where I'm going to leave you. If you missed any portion of the program, therickssmithshow.com. Stitcher on the smartphone. It's great having you here. Any thoughts, any comments, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Thanks for being here.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the moon.